Agents of Entropy by Hassan Rashid. Chapter 1. The Lost World. The year was 1776. As soon as the white man caught sight of Angoli, he pointed the blunderbuss at her and ordered her to come to him. As she approached, he commanded her to get down on her knees, and she asked, "Why?" He hit her on the side of the head with the butt of his weapon, and she collapsed unconscious. When she came to that evening in a large hut, she was surrounded by natives who had placed a wet rag over her forehead. She tried to get up but felt dizzy. One native woman pulled her down and told her to rest. The native woman's name was Katmano, and she explained that they were all from the Katamali tribe. Angoli felt uncomfortable and started to pull at what she was wearing. "What is all this that binds me so?" she asked. Katmano responded and said, "The white man ordered them to dress you in what he thought was appropriate." Angoli then asked why they were not living in the jungle, and an old native man named Olmati said, "The white men of Tongaluda came, captured the tribe, and took us away to this camp. The Tongaluda beasts and their helpers put the curse on our tribe, and many died of a strange and cruel sickness." Angoli explained that was what had happened to her tribe, the Bantula, a long time ago, and that she was trying to reunite with them. Old man Olmati said he did not recognize that tribal name. He indicated that she will have a hard time leaving this encampment because she will be put to work and guarded by the white man with, as he put it, the death stick. Angoli stayed 6 days working in the hot sun, clearing and burning brush for her shelter and food. In the very early dawn of the 7th day, and hours before anybody woke up, she snuck out of the hut she was in and crawled through the encampment until she was out of anybody's sight. She stood up and continued west toward the Green Mountains. 2 days and 4 rain deluges later, she walked into a thicket of greenery on the edge of a thriving jungle. As she walked, she took off her shoes and then her blouse. Next off was her skirt. Finally, she took off her underclothes, tossed them, and entered into the mass of trees. She was not alone in her trek. Every one of her steps was being followed by hidden eyes in that rainforest. They were eyes suspicious of strangers coming into their territory. The dynamic of protecting a territory had changed from guarding against other tribes coming in, but now the trespass of white men. In Angoli's case, they were doubly concerned because they saw her disrobe and they thought she was a white man's helper in disguise. As she dug around and pulled on a tuber that contained water, an arrow hit the exposed part of the plant and she stopped. She stood up and looked around and could now see shadows behind the foliage. She shouted, "I am a friend! I am a friend! My name is Angoli, and I come from a tribe called the Bantula." Another arrow hit a nearby tree, and she decided to submit, laying prostrate on the ground in the customary way of the Bantula. This seemed to appease the watching eyes, and the figures behind the vegetation started to come forward. There were 6 of them, and as they came upon Angoli, the figures started to touch her face, arms, legs, and private parts, as they spoke in a language she did not understand. She started to tense up. The figures then formed a circle around her and started a discussion among themselves on what to do with her. Finally, they decided she was young enough to be incorporated into their tribe. One of the figures, who was a woman, told Angoli, "Uome Watali Maya," as she motioned for her to get up and follow her. Angoli was led into a camp clearing consisting of a long permanent structure with a thatched roof, outside of which was a campfire. It was midday, and women were busy preparing the daily meal as they sang and laughed. Angoli was then told to go with one of the young girls to collect dry wood for the campfire that night, and they did so in a matter of 30 minutes. The whole tribe of 15 individuals plus Angoli sat and partook in the daily meal together, after which they rested in the large structure out of the rain that came down approximately 1 hour later. Around the campfire at night, they sang and acted out stories Angoli didn't fully understand, so she went along humming when she could. One night, they asked her to sing a song she knew. She did, and impressed the tribe with her high-pitched but mellow voice. Angoli learned the technique of building a shelter for herself and the types of food to gather from the jungle that were safe to eat. After 4 weeks, Angoli managed to pick up enough of their language to find out they were the Ilongeti tribe, and expressed her desire to go looking for her tribe and mother. they told her that based on the mark under her lower lip, a tribe with a similar marking lived 6 days' travel to the north. They told her she would have to go it alone, for they had no one to spare to accompany her. 3 days later, Angoli took an ember from the fire pit and placed it in a banana leaf as she was taught to do, in order to keep it lit and protected from the rain. She then headed north. The Elongeti tribesmen taught her how to keep traveling north by heading toward a mountain called Gabal Talib, which was distinguishable by its square, black rock crown. The jungle was very thick with trees, so in order to see this mountain, she had to climb a tree until she could see it. Angoli grew tired on the fourth day and became a little less attentive to the fire ember, and it was extinguished by the downpour of the afternoon rain. That meant she could not cook any of her food, and she had no evening campfire for protection. 3 days later, she still had not encountered anybody, and she wondered if she ever would. On the eighth morning, as she was climbing a tree to check on Mount Gabal Talib, she slipped and fell about 10 feet to the ground and lost consciousness. When she came to, she was in a hut being tended to because of her scratches and bruises by a young girl with a mark under her lower lip. "What's your name?" Angoli asked the young girl in the Bantulo dialect. She answered, "Lomalo. What is yours?" Angoli answered, "Angoli, daughter of Mangoliga of the Bantula tribe." The young girl ran out yelling, "She is Bantuli, she is Bantuli." Several heads appeared in the hut's opening and were then pushed aside by an elder tribesman who entered and sat next to Angoli. "Welcome, Mangaliga's daughter. I am Tetlonga, Mangaliga's youngest brother." Fighting the pain of her fall, Angoli reached out her arms and Tetlonga embraced her. Tetlonga was now the eldest of the tribe and considered the wisest. He made sure Angoli was comfortable in her convalescence. A day later, Angoli attended the nightly gathering around the campfire and learned that the tribe did not live in that part of the jungle when her mother was present. They were driven out of their original territory east of where they currently were after the Washanga battle with the white men of the Wazongos. After the tribe lost that battle where 6 tribesmen were killed, the Wazongos took their women away, including her mother Mangaliga and herself. "Where did they take us?" asked Angoli. Tetlonga told her that the women were taken to the Wazongo camp to please the workers, and they never saw them again. After the Washanga battle, there were only 4 men left in the tribe. They decided to head west deeper into the jungle where they encountered the Koloka tribe, who did not want them there, and so the Kalashanga battle was fought. In that battle, 8 Koloka men died, and the 3 remaining fled deeper into the jungle. All that remained were the women and children whom the Bantulo took into their new tribal territory. Home again. The 9 rusty iron beads hanging around her neck symbolized the number of times Angoli's mother gave birth, and Angoli was number 9. All her elder sisters were taken away by the white men. All that was left were her brothers, 2 of whom died in battle. The tribe let her stay in the camp while they went hunting during the morning for the first few days. After that, she would go out with them in the mornings, joining the women and girls in gathering the fruits, nuts, and mushrooms as they chased the game animals into the men's nets. The main source of meat was the Taglusi prized rodent, which the men shot with their poisoned darts. Before the hunt in the morning, the women and girls would gather their equipment, which consisted of baskets that they carried on their backs and digging sticks which they used to dig up tubers. The men and boys would make sure they had enough nets and darts as they made chants to the spirits of the animals they would catch that day. After the hunt, the women would prepare the meal of the day as they sang. Angoli learned quickly several of those songs, and within a few days would sing along with them. Sometimes she would dance to the music of their voices. Meanwhile, the men would repair their nets and replenish their supply of darts in preparation for the next day's hunt. There were certain songs that the men would join in with chants, but most of the time they talked among themselves about the morning hunt. The whole tribe would then gather around the fire pit and have their meal presented to them on large, fresh banana tree leaves. The children were presented with the food first, and after they had their fill, the adults would eat. When all the food was consumed, there was nothing left except bones, animal skins, and nutshells. The bones and nutshells were gathered in the leaves and buried outside the camp and under the buleto tree. The skins were used for clothing such as loincloths, straps, pockets, and little bags to carry the various utensils they used. After the daily meal, they would rest in their huts for a while until dusk arrived, at which time the young girls would go out and gather the wood needed for the fire pit that evening as the women prepared the area around it. Darkness ushered in song and dance that depicted stories of their creation, stories of their ancestors, and most recently, the story of their battles and hunts. The story of their creation described the emergence of a salamander from the waters and its marriage to the spirit of the forest, giving forth the tribe's original mother and father, whose names were Alik and Balik, respectively. One song that they sang was about the courtship between them, where Alik would place the binto flower behind her right ear, signaling to Balik that she was ready to mate. Another song depicted a prayer to the Taglusi rodent, whom they thank for the gift of sustenance and for giving them the ability to have many children. The tribe, in turn, only killed the adult rodent and left the children rodents to thrive. The tribe only stayed in any one location for 5 or 6 nights before moving on to the next place to camp. When they perform this migration from one camp to the next, the men lead as they sing the migration song announcing their presence in the forest. When they arrive at their next campsite, the young girls gather the materials needed to build huts as the women build them, and in a matter of an hour, all the huts are completed. Meanwhile, the men and boys prepare the large fire pit by digging a shallow depression in the ground. They gather the wood and start the fire from the embers they carried with them. Lost in Translation. The forest was a tropical rainforest covering approximately 30,000 square miles. It was inhabited by the Gutrial hunter-gatherers, who were some of the oldest indigenous people of the Congo River Basin. It was not known how long they, the Gutrial people, had been living in the forest. The Bantulo tribe was part of the Gutrial complex. The Bantulo tribe consisted of 25 members, and they occupied a territory of approximately 31 square miles. One morning, as the men and boys were out setting up their trapping nets, they ran across a small, fresh campsite that belonged to 1 or 2 people, and the fire pit was still smoldering. That indicated to them that they had intruders in their territory. They quickly called off the hunt to concentrate on finding the trespassers. One of the men examined the foliage around this camp and figured out their escape route. So the men and boys formed a straight line, shoulder to shoulder, and started moving forward in the direction of that escape route. Within an hour, they ran across a young man lying prostrate on the ground, surrendering to them with fear in his eyes. The Gutrial people of the region had their common language, so they were able to communicate with the young man and found out that he escaped from a slave work camp and had nowhere else to go. The men discussed among themselves what to do with this young muscular male, and they decided to incorporate him into the tribe. When they informed the young man of the decision, he went around trying to kiss the feet of the men and boys surrounding him. This was not the way of the Bantulo. They didn't understand what he was trying to do, so Wanuto grabbed his arm, pulled him up, and told him he was one of the Bantulo tribe now. Wanuto then turned him around, looking at his muscular body, and commented that he was a strong man and will contribute greatly to the tribe. One by one, the rest of the men and boys did the same thing to the young man. They gave him the name of Koangaliji. All the men and boys returned to the camp. On their way back, they managed to hunt for their daily needs of protein rations. Upon arrival, they introduced Koangaliji to the rest of the tribe. The women took the meat and started preparing it for the daily meal, along with what they gathered. That evening, the campfire festivities were centered around the introduction of Koangaliji to the story of the Bantulo tribe. They performed and sang the drama and song of creation, where Angoli played the part of the salamander that crawled out of the water, among other skits that distinguished them from other tribes in that vast forest. Soon thereafter, a deluge of rain dropped down on them, and they had to take cover in their huts. Both Angoli and Koangaliji were placed in the same hut. All stayed there until the jungle started to get dark. The sounds of the natives started to pick up a rhythm. Angoli stuck her head outside and saw the tribe gathering around fire pit. Both Angoli and Koangoliji sat outside their hut watching what was going on. First, the tribe adults stood in a large circle around the campfire as a young girl crawled from one side of the circle to the center close to the fire. Then a young boy with leaves tied to his flapping arms approached the girl and fed her with his mouth what Angoli thought was a fig. More young kids joined the skit, some with masks resembling animals, others resembling trees. The children interlocked one leg to the leg of the next and started to hop in unison around the campfire. The adult members of the tribe then started to sing louder. After the singing was over, the tribe sat down with their children and started to discuss the events of the day. The camp was dark by now, and the only light was from the campfire flickering in the faces of the tribe's people. The tribe's elders started to sing once again after the discussions waned. This time a hollow log was used as a drum. Gradually, the crowd thinned out as people returned to their huts for the night, as did Angoli and Koangoliji. The next morning, they were awakened by a young girl who yelled into their hut, "Ishu," and then waited outside. As Angoli and Koangoliji emerged, the girl motioned for them to follow her. When they reached a long row of women and young girls holding sticks, Angoli and Koangoliji were given each a stick, were placed at the beginning of the row, and the group started to walk forward while thrashing the vegetation as they yelled, "Who?" The women also picked mushrooms and other edibles, throwing them into baskets they carried on their backs. Angoli and Koangoliji imitated what was happening and moved along with the women and girls. Pretty soon they could see the vegetation in front of them move as small animals scurried away. This continued for about a half hour until they reached the men who were holding on to nets. As the little animals ran into the nets, they were captured. The men repeated the words, "Rabina Yakalikom," which meant, "Bless you, reborn you will be." In the Bantulo tribe, there was no pairing of women and men, nor was there marriage. The tribe is one family, and all individuals are cared for and loved by all others. There are no long-term sexual partners. There are no sexual partner rules, except that brothers and sisters cannot have sexual relations. Bantulo children recognize that all men are their fathers and all women are their mothers. All adults recognize the children of the tribe as their own. At night, a woman may pair or may not pair with a man as a sleeping partner. The same goes for men. That is not to say that men or women do not have a favorite partner to sleep with for any length of time. Angoli developed a fondness for Koangoliji and would put Binto flower behind her right ear, glancing at him often and signaling that she was ready to mate. They spent many a night in each other's arms. Angoli wondered often why she was drawn to Koangoliji or he to her. To her, his muscular physique was attractive. There was also the fact that they were both outsiders coming into the tribe that drew them together. They often made mistakes in interpreting what was going on within the tribe during normal everyday activities and were frequently corrected. For example, Angoli was asked to wash and peel a tuber for their afternoon meal, so she jumped into the nearest pool of water to take a bath. This caused the whole tribe to break out in laughter, some of whom actually fell to the ground in uncontrollable fits of hilarity. These occasions were not meant to degrade Angoli, but were genuinely happy moments for the whole tribe. Danger. One day the tribe sensed that there were intruders in their territory because they found strange objects floating in one of the ponds. The tribespeople didn't know what they were except for Angoli and Koangoliji, who recognized a soggy handkerchief, a sign that the white men were encroaching upon the tribe's territory. To Angoli, this meant danger, for it was well known that many of those outsiders carried diseases that tribespeople died from. Angoli and Koangoliji could do little but warn the tribesmen of the danger. A few weeks later, as the tribe was convalescing after a great meal, armed strangers, some black men, and others white, walked into the camp and started to wake the tribe up using the butts of their guns. As Koangoliji and the other tribesmen started to go for their spears and poisoned darts, Angoli begged them not to fight, for she realized that it would be futile. but Koangoloji had already sent off a poisoned dart at one of the intruders that missed, and the intruder then shot Koangoloji in the abdomen. The shot was so loud that it startled the whole tribe. Angoli continued to insist not to fight back as she rushed to comfort Koangoloji. The women fled into the surrounding jungle as the men took a stand and started to fight. Gunfire erupted, nets were thrown, and soon the men were immobilized and chained along with Angoli, and all were marched away, leaving Koangoloji, by himself, dying. The march took about 2 days, after which they reached the coast of West Africa and were chained in the gallows of a large ship called the Challenger, which sailed west to the harbor of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Chapter 2. The Other Planet Earth. As the Challenger docked at Portsmouth, the crew yelled, "Hooray!" for it was a long and hard trip across the Atlantic Ocean, as many were starting to show signs of scurvy. His Majesty's Royal Short and Heavy Tax Collector stood at the dock to collect the dues owed the King of England. He walked the plank and climbed on board, requesting the ship's manifest from the captain, William Whipple, who was waiting with the document under his arm and holding on to the steering wheel. The skipper had an average stature, wore a blue captain's cap over long, wavy black hair, and gripped with his yellowing teeth a wooden pipe that was smoldering and emitting a sweet apple-like scent. He wore a brown vest over his soiled blue sweater. His brown leather pants were held up with a rope weaved through half a dozen loops around his waist. On the waist rope hung a pouch that contained all he owned in gold coins. The two men shook hands and proceeded to Captain Whipple's quarters, where the tax collector took possession of the manifest and was studying it carefully, as Captain Whipple said, "We have lost a considerable amount of merchandise that is recorded on the manifest. I suggest you take inventory of what is left." "I will take your word for what was lost from the manifest," said the tax collector, and proceeded to read out loud the items recorded. 16 100-pound containers of spice, and Captain Whipple responded, "Present." 12 bundles of animal hides, Captain Whipple responded, "Only 9 bundles remain." 13 negroes, Captain Whipple responds, "Only 6 survived." 2 caged wild cats, the captain responded, "2 spotted cats are present." 6 cages of wild birds, Captain Whipple responded, "Only 4 cages remain on board." 600 bundles of cloth from Egypt, Captain Whipple responded, "Present." When the taxman was done recording what remained of the merchandise on board the ship, he calculated the tax as the equivalent of 1 negro, which he presented to Captain Whipple. "Very well. Shall we take a look at the negroes?" responded Captain Whipple, and both of them proceed to the galleys. The captain was used to the stench, but the taxman was holding his nose shut as he tried to keep his breakfast. When the taxman saw Angoli's naked body laying down, his eyes brightened up and said, "I want her," as he pointed at a skeleton of a woman with hands and feet chained to the hull of the ship. "She is spoken for," said Captain Whipple, and proceeded to another skeleton, saying, "This one, when fattened up, will work wonders," and proceeded to unchain him from the hull and presented him to the taxman. After some negotiations, the taxman departed with another male negro who was in better condition. As the taxman departed with the payment, Captain Whipple asked the second in command, Mr. Clyde, to find Dr. Matthew and have him tend to the rest of the negroes on board before any more of them died. "Yes, sir," said Mr. Clyde, who jumped ship and hurried down Front Street to the doctor's clinic, located between the Old Hag's Saloon and Jake's Mercantile, but one of the negroes died before the doctor reached the ship. Dr. Matthew tended to the crew, and the rest of the negroes, and prescribed rest and a diet to follow for all to recover their hardship. The doctor took extra care of Angoli, to whom she was to be his bed warmer once plumped up over the summer, a gift from Captain Whipple for the doctor's diligent care of the captain's wife, Catherine, when she came down with typhoid a year earlier. Dr. Matthew was a handsome buck. He was born in Ireland and arrived in the New Hampshire colony a few years earlier. His hair was straight and blacker than it was brown, with clear blue eyes. He had a wardrobe of 4 long white coats that served as his trademark look. Dr. Matthew and Captain Whipple belonged to a secret society called the Rabid Dog's Leg, formed to find ways to resist the British oppressive rule in the colony of New Hampshire. The third member of the society was Dr. Josiah Bartlett, who was the leader and contact person to other organizations resisting British rule. The society's name came from an incident involving a rabid dog that wandered into the north part of Portsmouth, where Dr. Josiah took his wide-barreled musket, loaded it with shot, gunpowder in its chamber, aimed and fired at the dog. Most of the dog disintegrated in the flash, except for one leg, which lay motionless in the street covered in blood. The rabid dog's leg meeting place was an ice fishing cabin on Parsons Lake, situated on Dr. Josiah Bartlett's estate. It was summer, the ice was gone, and the cabin lay strapped to a couple of floating logs about 20 yards from shore, with a worn wooden walkway leading to it. The cabin was skirted by a deck about 4 feet wide. As Dr. Josiah led the way across the walkway, with its missing planks, worn ropes, and ties, he asked Dr. Matthew, who was right behind him, if his mission to blow up the British munitions depot at the south end of the city was successful. Just as Dr. Matthew was about to answer, he stepped on a plank that broke and was about to fall into the lake, when Captain Whipple, who was right behind him, managed to hang on to the doctor. His coattails and averted a complete dunking in the cool waters. After reaching the fishing cabin, Dr. Matthew responded, "Partially successful, Josiah. The gunpowder is gone, but the guns were scattered around the compound." "That is all right," responded Dr. Josiah as he entered the cabin and sat on an inverted bucket in the corner. "They can't use the guns this way, which is good." Dr. Ty. Josiah had returned from a trip to the colony of Virginia a few days earlier, where he met with other colony statesmen desiring freedom from the red coats and to explore the type of government to form after the colonies achieved independence from England. "What was the outcome of your trip to Virginia, Dr. Josiah?" asked the captain, who was standing and holding onto a rope dangling from the ceiling next to the door. Some members of the meeting were extremely adamant and arguing for a kingdom. The meeting ended with no conclusion, except that the leader of the new country was to be a gentleman by the name of George Washington. As they discussed the matter of the governess, the cabin swayed and rocked in response to gentle waves hitting its side, causing dangling fishing lines and ropes to rub against their cheeks. All of a sudden, a great wind rocked the cabin violently, causing Dr. Josiah to fall off his bucket, while Dr. Matthew was tossed off balance, falling into the fishing hole in the middle of the shed. Captain Whipple managed to stay standing since he was used to rocking ship decks. A blinding light flashed into the cabin from the window opposite the door with a deafening sound. They all rushed and looked through the window to behold a huge dinner plate hovering above. It was twice as big as a battleship, with lanterns that somehow turned on and off. After about a minute, a ramp was slowly lowered down to the lake right in front of the cabin's window. Then two figures appeared to slide down it. As the two strangers came closer to the cabin, the three activists could see a man on the right and a machine of some sort to the left. The machine had two legs, two arms, a dome for a head, and a chest containing a lantern that moved from side to side. The machine was twice as tall as the man, who was about 6 feet tall. They both stopped about 10 feet in front of the cabin, and the man held his palm up and said, "We come in peace. I am known as Cletaw," and then pointed to the machine and said, "This is my companion, Gorot." "What kind of names are those?" exclaimed Captain Whipple, who grabbed his pistol from his belt and aimed it at Cletaw. But before he could get off a shot, the machine opened a slit in its dome, where a beam of light shot out at the pistol, evaporating it from the Captain Whipple's hand. As the three stood in awe, Cletaw said, "It is fruitless to aggress against us. We come in peace. We desire to inform you of the consequences of your future actions and choices. We intend to do you no harm but help you in your kind. You are on a journey, and we want to help you in the choices you make on your way. You were chosen for your passion and commitment to your expedition. You were chosen because of your status and influence." Gorot then directed a blue beam from his dome and touched each of their heads, which caused the three men to feel at ease, trustworthy, and agreeable with the whole situation. "Doctor," Josiah adjusted his monocle and said, "How are you going to guide us on our journey?" When Cletaw said, "We will take you to planet Earth B, on the exact opposite side of the sun to experience what they had experienced. Confused, Dr. Josiah wiped his monocle with a handkerchief out of his vest pocket, then placed the monocle back over his right eye and exclaimed, "Planet B. What is that?" putting his right hand in the pocket of his blue vest. "Planet Earth B is a heavenly body named Perutha, much like your Earth and sort of a duplicate. It revolves on the opposing side around the sun, approximately 189 million miles from here," replied Kletaw. Scratching his head with his finger underneath his white wig, causing it to wiggle a bit, Dr. Josiah went on to say, "I have never heard of such a distance. What do you mean, sort of a duplicate? You will see when you arrive there," replied Kletaw, and then the three found their legs moving them to the door of the cabin and exit. They came into close proximity to the two aliens and climbed onto the ramp. Kletaw then said, "Let us go," turned around, and proceeded to walk back up to the spaceship. The machine followed. Dr. Josiah's legs followed the machine, so did Dr. Matthew and Captain Whipple's limbs. Chapter 3, Mr. Isaac Nortino. Dr. Josiah, Dr. Matthew, and the captain stood in the spaceship in front of a large picture, which displayed the lake with the cabin floating on it. It was a strange sight for the three travelers. They had never been floating in the air so high. Kletaw stood in front of a table with protruding levers and proceeded to move them around as the captain marveled at what he was doing. All of a sudden, the spaceship accelerated away from the lake, taking their breath away. "What is happening?" asked Dr. Josiah of Kletaw. "My travel vehicle is moving away from your Earth, and we are on our journey to Earth B," responded Kletaw. The captain took his portable sextant out of his pocket and proceeded to check out their coordinates, but soon took off his cap and scratched his head. "I can't find where we are," he exclaimed. "Who are you?" asked Dr. Josiah with a perplexed look on his face. Before Kletaw could answer, they all heard a flatulate. One of the gentlemen was reacting to the events taking place in the picture, where objects were becoming smaller and smaller. The image in the picture was now of North America. "I am from the planet Zerbadu, and I have been sent to take you to Earth B," responded Kletaw. "Why?" asked Dr. Josiah. "I have no answer to your question, doctor," responded Kletaw. "Why?" asked Dr. Josiah. "I follow my instructions when I receive the Ba impulse, much like how your legs followed the impulse Gaurat beamed to your minds," responded Kletaw. Dr. Josiah looked frustrated. Dr. Matthew looked at the moving picture and caught sight of the bluish ball encompassing the whole moving picture and asked, "What is that?" "That is your Earth. We are now picking up speed and will arrive at Earth B soon," responded Kletaw as he turned to the doctor. All three travelers stood in awe at the sight of their Earth growing smaller on the moving picture. After a few seconds, they could see it take its place among the stars of the sky. A few more seconds passed, and a bright star appeared on the moving picture that steadily grew larger. It was silvery in color, with many blurry objects floating around it that struck it with what looked like bolts of lightning. Soon the blurry objects became small versions of the larger star, with what looked like sticks protruding towards the larger star and huge wings. It was from these sticks that the bolts of lightning were emitted. The larger star now started to engulf the whole moving picture. "Is this Earth B?" asked Dr. Josiah. "Yes, it is," responded Kletaw. "It looks nothing like our Earth as we just saw on the moving picture a minute or two ago," said Dr. Josiah. "Yes, it does look different. Does it not?" "That is because it is slightly older than your Earth by about 300 years, responded Kletaw. "What do you mean it is older by 300 years? Asked Dr. Josiah. "It means that it is advanced in history compared to your Earth," answered Kletaw. The captain used his portable sextant to find out where they were and said, as he held it up to his eye and said, "We are in a very strange place." Kletaw explained to the three that there was an extremely dangerous and invisible force of unknown origin on Earth B, which consumes every human it encounters. It lurks everywhere ready to strike at any time, so they had to be quick when they land. Within a minute, the ramp once again was lowered, and Kletaw led the three travelers down to the surface of Earth B. He then made them rush into the mouth of a cave hidden behind a flat piece of silvery metal or glass facing the sun, and started to run down a lit tunnel. After about 400 yards, he stopped in front of a huge closed silver door and pressed a protruding blemish on its surface. The three travelers were out of breath. Dr. Josiah had his hands on his knees as he tried to catch his breath, while the captain was leaning on the wall of the cave. Matthew was the youngest, and so he recovered the fastest. The door was opened, and there was a beautiful woman with long blonde hair gently gathered and twisted on her left shoulder, dressed in what looked like a lace nightgown, who introduced herself as Calidoria, the daughter of Isaac Nortino. The only strange thing about her was she had small elephant ears. When she saw Cletaw, she understood what the three travelers were all about, and greeted them, touching each of their right elbows with hers, and invited them to come in. Just then, a great roar echoed through the tunnel, and the door automatically shut with a thud behind that startled the three travelers and Cletaw. As Dr. Matthew passed by Calidoria, he reached out and felt her gown between his thumb and index finger. She thought he was kind of good-looking. After all, he was the only one with exposed natural dark hair and a scruffy black beard. She didn't care much for his long, lightly blood-spattered white coat, but she had not seen a real man before, except for her father, Isaac Nortino. Her hormones then raged within her, expressed by the moisture she could feel gathering between her legs and the fluttering of her ears. She led the way through more tunnels until they reached a huge, humming, colossal chamber, perhaps 1,000 feet one way, by 1,000 feet the other, and a ceiling approximately 100 feet up. There were large barrels-like objects made of a metallic substance connected by cables that wandered out of the chamber through smaller holes in the walls. They proceeded into this colossal room, and as they walked around one of those barrels, got sight of a heavy-set man slouched on a sofa with a short table in front of him, scattered with sheets of paper, some laid flat with diagrams and numbers written on them, while others were crumpled up. He also had small elephant ears. "Father, please meet the three gentlemen from the other earth," said Calidoria. Calidoria's father stood up with difficulty, approached the three visitors, put his arm around her shoulders in a caring, loving way, and introduced himself. "Welcome, friends. We were expecting you. I am Isaac Nortino. I believe my daughter introduced herself to you," as he rubbed elbows with them. He was about 50 years old, with a graying beard, kind of short in stature, an unkempt head of straight hair, and walked with a cane. He wore a silvery skin-tight suit with an insignia of some kind of a blue flying bird. "We have been updating our vocabulary to include your language, and I hope we do well in our communications with you." The captain introduced himself as Captain Whipple of the Challenger, a merchant vessel in service to the king. Dr. Matthew introduced himself as a doctor of human reproductive illnesses, while Dr. Josiah introduced himself as a doctor of the mind and a statesman for the colony of New Hampshire to the central command for the independence of the colonies from England. "Excuse me, Mr. Nortino, but I don't understand how you came to know of our journey here," exclaimed Dr. Josiah. "I put a signal out to space asking for help, and it was received by the planet Zerbatu that sent Cletaw to us," responded Isaac Nortino. "The help we needed was to disseminate the seed of advanced thought to other planets. Cletaw told us that the situation on your Earth was hopeless, and the best we could do was to teach its inhabitants by imparting to you, three visitors, the advances and wisdom discovered here. Cletaw informed us of your juxtapositioned planet Earth and said it would be a good start. I am sorry for all the questions, Mr. Nortino, but why are you and your daughter living in these tunnels? Why aren't you on the surface of your planet Perutha?" asked Dr. Josiah. "Chapter 4, Their Philosophy. We took cover in these tunnels to avoid contact with the invisible Zactulum. Zactulum is an entity that has no purpose that we know of," said Isaac Nortino. "Where did this entity come from?" asked Dr. Josiah. "No one knows," responded Isaac Nortino. "Surely, it came from somewhere," exclaimed Dr. Josiah. Isaac Nortino invited the three visitors to sit down. "That will be all," he said as he looked at Calidoria lovingly and Cletaw. After the departure of Calidoria and Cletaw, Isaac Nortino turned to the three visitors and said, "I guess I will have to start from the beginning." He cleared his throat and continued, In the distant past, our planet was a place dependent totally on the energy the sun provided. It was a primitive life. The terrestrial living evolved a system of recycling minerals from the topmost 30 buses of the surface of the planet. "Excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Nortino, but what is buses?" asked Dr. Josiah. "It is a unit of measure about the length of the first joint of your index finger," answered Isaac Nortino. "So it is about an inch in length," nodded Dr. Josiah, looking at Dr. Matthew and the captain, who looked relieved they were able to follow the conversation. Just then the room shook and rumbled. They heard a muffled roar as bits and pieces of the ceiling started to fall on them. "What was that?" asked Dr. Matthew of Isaac Nortino with a frightened look on his face. "Don't worry, doctor. That was Zach Tulum. It can't reach us here." "You are all safe," he responded. They all looked around the chamber and waited for the next episode, but it never came. So Isaac Nortino continued where he had left off in the conversation. "For the most part, each species evolved a livelihood where the births were equal to deaths in any one group. Life revolved around the rise of the sun in the morning and its setting in the evening. In addition, and although they had ambition, they did not develop a method that would allow them to break away from that cyclical lifestyle. When humans evolved, they simply adapted the original primitive cyclical way of living. This continued for millions of years. The daily routine consisted of a few hours of hunting and foraging in the morning. Then came food preparation and consumption, in which all participated with song. In the evening, the group would assemble around the fire pit, telling stories, dancing, and singing. Somewhere in the far past, an old wise man who was a great observer noticed the smoke of the fire pit dissipated into the night air and wondered why. He also observed food dissipated similarly. Food was gathered in one locality and then defecated in a multitude of other localities throughout the day and night, eventually disappearing into thin air. It was said his name was Entropiani, from which came the term entropy, meaning the world is in a process of constant mixing dissipation. "I never heard of such a process," said Dr. Josiah as his monocle dropped from his eye. "That sounds absurd," said the captain. "The stars in the sky do not mix or dissipate. They are there night after night." "That sounds the opposite of that, I understand. A woman eats many different foods gathered from far and wide, feeding her unborn child, and in the end gives birth," said Dr. Matthew. Just then a high-pitched bell rang, and Isaac Nortino told the three visitors that dinner was served, and he led the way into the next chamber, the dining room, which had a round table laden with various foods and five chairs around it. From the opposite end of the chamber enters Caledoria wearing a tight-fitting jumpsuit. She looked even more beautiful to Dr. Matthew than when he first saw her. He knew he could not feel her materials this time without pinching her, so he decided not to make a scene. As Caledoria and Isaac Nortino encouraged the three visitors to try the food presented to them, Dr. Josiah asked, "When we approached your planet Perutha, we saw a multitude of strange sights and floating objects. How did they all come to be?" "That was all created when the quest for knowledge came about," replied Isaac Nortino. "That is a long story, and I prefer to leave it for another day, perhaps tomorrow." After dinner, they all retired to the sleeping chamber a short distance from the dining room through another tunnel. There was only one chamber in which all could relax and sleep. Caledoria showed each of the three visitors where to sleep. Each bed was situated in a cavity that was 4 feet high and 7 feet deep in the wall of the chamber. On one side of the chamber was a row of six cavities. The first three were reserved for the three visitors. On the other side of the chamber were two cavities, one for each of Caledoria and Isaac Nortino. The lights were then dimmed after they all got situated. Within an hour, Dr. Matthew snuck into Caledoria's cavity and was sadly kicked out immediately. He crawled back into his cavity, not understanding what exactly happened. He knew that there was chemistry between them that was sexual, so he asked himself why his advance did not pan out. Chapter 5, Their Beliefs. The next morning, as they sat at the breakfast table, Caledoria introduced Dr. Matthew to something called gibna. He tasted it and said, "This reminds me of cheese." "Cheese? What is that?" she exclaimed. "It is a product of milk," he replied. "What is milk?" she asked. It is a product that we get from cows, he responded. What is cows? She asked. The captain and the two doctors burst out in a laugh. They did not believe she knew not what a cow was. Dr. Matthew continued, Cows is plural for cow, which is an animal. Men who deal in milk get up early in the morning and get milk from their cows by pulling on the cow's tits, spraying the milk into a bucket. It comes out as a liquid, much like it would come out of your tits when you have a child, as he looked at her breasts. Caledoria became embarrassed at this point, as her cheeks turned pink and looked down at her lap. Sorry, Caledoria, I did not mean to embarrass you, he said apologetically, and then got back on track with an explanation on how to make cheese. The milkman then takes his collection of milk and exposes it to a substance that converts the milk into a semi-solid liquid, which then is strained in gauze and aged to make the final product of cheese. You, how gross and primitive, she complained. How do you make your gibna? Asked the captain as he pointed at the plate of gibna at the table. Caledoria looked to her father, Ezek Nortino, for help, and he came to the rescue with, You see, captain, we make gibna from idurk oil. It is a substance we discovered in the ground many, many suns ago. It is boiled and separated into fractions in towers. One fraction is called laban, which is converted into gibna through another process where artificial colors and flavors are added. As a result, you are eating the end product. I may add here that cows did exist in our past, but they could not compete with our modern technologies and became extinct. It is much more efficient to produce gibna than it did to produce what you call cheese. But cheese tastes so much better than this gibna, said Dr. Josiah. I think taste is a product of what a person is used to. We are used to gibna and think highly of it, while you are used to cheese, said Ezek Nortino. I don't think we could ever go back to eating cheese, and now that we have no cows, we can't even think of it. The conversation became quiet at this point as each continued to eat. Ezek Nortino took out some sort of box from his pocket and proceeded to take pills from it and swallow them with a cup of water. Dr. Matthew asked him what he was doing, and Ezek Nortino said, These are medications I take for my health. What are they for, may I ask? Asked Dr. Matthew. Well, this blue one is for my colitis, and this pink pill is for the side effect of the blue pill, replied Ezek Nortino. Side effect? What is that? Asked Dr. Matthew. You see, the colitis blue pill is extremely effective, but it causes me to be paranoid. So I take the pink pill to get rid of this nasty side effect, responded Ezek Nortino. I noticed also a red pill. What is it for? Asked Dr. Matthew. The red pill is to counteract the pink pill, which causes me to have uncontrolled tremors of my fingers and toes, said Ezek Nortino. How about the big white pill you swallowed? What does it do? Asked Dr. Matthew. When I was born, I had a very long nose. This white pill gave me a shorter one, as you can see, said Ezek Nortino as he touched his nose with his index finger. And the green pill, what does it do for you? Asked the doctor. The green pill takes care of my erectile dysfunction, said Ezek Nortino. Lastly, the two-tone pill, what does it do? Asked the doctor. Ezek Nortino responded and said, As you can see, I am the only man on Perutha, and there are no women left for me. The two-tone pill prevents my penis from erecting. The chamber went silent once again, and after about 2 to 3 minutes, Dr. Josiah interrupted the quietness with, You were about to tell us about all we observed on our way to Perutha. It had to do with knowledge. Ah, yes, we were discussing why our ancestors decided to seek knowledge, said Ezek Nortino. You see, there were many belief systems floating around our planet, and a couple or three took hold. They preached Perutha was made for humans to use as they saw fit. They also preached that whoever believed in them were considered superior to all others, and that it was their duty to convert all who did not believe. This caused the impetus to forgo the old way of living, in which the whole environment, including its human inhabitants, were part of the sun energy cyclical system, and embarked on the quest for knowledge to create the tools to help the chosen ones to compete and spread the words of these new faiths around Perutha. This resulted in the ages of genocide, where whole populations were killed off to take their wealth or subdue them to make room for those who believed in those new faiths that today are called Misihia. Don't be mistaken about the Misihia faiths. They reflected what was in our hearts all along. The Masihiya faiths simply transferred the message to the minds of humans, where it commanded their powers of logic. The final result was what you observed on your approach to Perutha. Is Masihis then the rule of law here? Asked the captain. Chapter 6. Their Government. After breakfast, the group proceeded to the colossal humming chamber and sat around the short table where the three visitors were introduced to Isaac Nortino upon their arrival. As they were settling, a great roar shook the chamber, rocking the large barrel-looking objects from side to side. Caledoria grabbed the arm of Dr. Matthew as she trembled, looked up at the ceiling, and followed by chunks falling. After the barrel-like objects stopped rocking, Isaac Nortino started to explain, "In order to answer your question, I need to add another layer of control that was used to govern the faithful populations. The Masihiya faiths also taught its heterogeneous populations how to cooperate with one another to have peace," said Isaac Nortino. This led to the realization a form of government needed to exist to augment the faiths in controlling the quest for knowledge. A group of 20 wise men had a conference to debate and come forth with an acceptable administration. It took about 12 years for the group to settle on the right regime. In the first 5 years, they were leaning towards democratic control, thinking it would give each person a say in the direction the governess would take. It seemed equitable at first until they tried to implement entropy, and they acknowledged each person had a different idea as to what it was and how to implement it. They realized the country in question acted like an organism, and so implementing democracy would be like the body choosing the liver to act as president, which did not make sense. In years 11 and 12, they looked at the Funtent as an example of how to live and understood that the brain controlled everything it did, from traveling, eating, searching, and fighting, among other functions. "Excuse me, but what is a Funtent?" Dr. Josiah asked, interrupting Isaac Nortino. "It is a large animal that roams the equatorial regions of Perutha," he responded, then continued. "The wise men concluded that each nation was like a live Funtent, and it should therefore have a central brain that accepts signals from the body on its condition and figure out what actions it should take to move on to the next step and ensure health and prosperity to it as a whole. In addition, the law of entropy was to be the guiding principle or prime directive of the country in order for its decisions to be natural. In conclusion, the flavor of the entropy-driven government chosen was that of the brainotratics." Zaktulam then roared again, but this time it was closer and shook some of the barrels and toppled some over. Isaac Nortino stood up and instructed the group to run to a tunnel marked Retless. It led to a fortified chamber with what looked like, to the three visitors, thick bands of steel holding up the ceiling. There they sat on the ground and in the dark. When the rumbling and roaring stopped, Dr. Matthew started to get up, but Isaac Nortino grabbed his arm and pulled him down. "Not yet," he said. They sat there for a few silent minutes when Dr. Matthew asked, "I don't understand why you take so many medications." "I am not that healthy, and so I take them," Isaac Nortino responded. "I mean, when you take one medication to offset a problem of another. It just does not make sense to me, and it sounds so inefficient," said Dr. Matthew. "Well, if you understood the concept of entropy, it would become clear why it is logical and efficient." Isaac Nortino responded and then declared the group could return to the colossal chamber. After they all got situated and sat down, Dr. Matthew continued with his quest to get the reason why so many medications were taken by Isaac Nortino and asked, "For example, you take an anti-erectile dysfunction pill and then take a medication to become dysfunctional again. That does not make sense to me." "My dear doctor, the principle of entropy is to achieve dispersal. The best way to achieve dispersal is to induce into the equation energy to achieve a higher entropy value. If you have one pill that I need to take, it will require one pill worth of energy to manufacture and distribute. The more pills you make and distribute, the more energy is consumed, and the greater the value of entropy that is achieved," said Isaac Nortino. Dr. Josiah interrupted the conversation with, "I beg to discuss this brainotratics you introduced earlier. What if the left leg forms a special interest group that convinces the brain to spend more time and effort on its behalf?" Isaac Nortino inquired, "I don't understand. What do you mean by convinces the brain?" bribed the brain to make decisions favorable to the left leg over the needs of other body parts, said Dr. Josiah. The scientific method was the only approach to understanding the truth of entropy, as opposed to the consensus of the masses that only yields mediocrity. The individuals who made up the whole body consisted of meek men and women who served as conscripts with a subsistence salary. Each organ of the body was a subpopulation that lived and bred youngsters who would take up the skills needed from their parents. The individuals who comprised the brain were also of the scientific persuasion who did the same. Only then did our species move in the required direction of zero special interest manipulation, confirmed Isaac Nortino. At this point, Caledoria grew bored hearing of what was obvious, and Dr. Yu noticed her rolling her eyes. Can we go somewhere else to talk? He whispered into her ear. Chapter 7. The Wooing. Matthew followed Caledoria through a labyrinth of tunnels and passages to an endless-looking cave where existed a large lake with no end in sight. The whole cave was lit by lights spaced apart by about 10 feet. Directly under each light grew tall plants, while other shorter ones grew farther away from the lights, making the whole scene around the lake look like the green velvet ropes hanging from the poles, leading opera-goers through the dark corridors of an opera house. She leads him to a bench under one of the lights, and they sat near each other. They listened to and caught sight of the small waves from the lake as they leaped onto shore. They themselves sat motionless in silence. A minute or two passed by as he tried to think of something to say when she came to the rescue with, "Is there a woman in your life, Dr. Matthew?" "No, ma'am." "Is there a man in your life, Caledoria?" "Yes," she answered. The doctor started to inch away from her before he realized what a dumb question that was and stopped. He understood he was back to step one with her and started once again to rack his brain for something to say. Finally, he held out his arms and commented, "What a beautiful place this is." "Surely, a handsome man like yourself can't be serious about not having a woman or two back home," she said. "Oh, I am sorry. I am engaged to Lady Bellingham. It is an arrangement that helped me immigrate from Ireland to the colonies," he responded. "I see. So it is an economic arrangement," she responded. "Yes, she is a well-off widow with 2 young boys, he adds. "As for me, I am married to Perutha, and it's destiny," she said. "You sound so fatalistic," he reacted. "What do you mean?" she asked. "What is your planet's destiny?" he asked back. "Our humanity has completed its duty to our god Entropy, and we see our destiny approaching. We will soon be annihilated as we exist today and be transformed," she answered. "That sounds terrible. Aren't you frightened?" he asked. "We will soon join the universe in its flux. I will be part of its march towards a higher level of existence," she answered. The doctor was not able to follow her logic, so he tried another approach, and said as he inched back closer to her side, "What if I decide to join you in this flux?" "You must be kidding," she reacted as a smile transformed her lips and her elephant ears flapped. "Why do you say that? Do you think I can't join you and accept your beliefs?" he asked. "Of course not. You are an alien to our world. To join us, you must have been raised from infancy to believe in the flux," she responded. "You must have breathed the fumes and drank from the chalice of entropy all your life. You can't be prepared to join me in my journey." "We have similar beliefs back on Earth. We also believe our world will end. The story is different than yours, but the end is pretty much the same, which is the death of humanity on Earth," he said as he also smiled. The large chamber became silent once again. He gazed at her dark brown eyes as she sat and looked at the endless lake. He reaches over and touches her left hand with his right fingers, and she does not resist. A moment later, she turned to him and asked, "At what are you looking?" "I am looking at you," he responded as he clasped her hand and moved closer to her. She accepted his advance and clutched his hand, but turned her head and fixed her eyes on the lake once again, embarrassed. A moment or two passed, and she turned to him, looked into his deep blue eyes, and then glanced at his lips as they grew closer. Her ears fluttered. She leaned her head slightly to accept him as he placed his lips on hers. The kiss lasted about 30 seconds, after which she collapsed into his arms. Later that day, Chapter 8, Zactulum. The high-pitched bell rang again, and they all assembled in the dining room for lunch. As each took to their seat, Zaktulim roared. The lights flickered, and they all sat there, looked up at the ceiling, covered the food with their napkins, and waited for the next roar that never came. Dr. Josiah inquired, as they all felt safe and returned their napkins to their laps. Surely, this powerful entity, as you once called it, has some sort of story based on fact or legend, does it not? Zaktulim has many folk tales about how it came about. One is that it is my mother-in-law scolding me for whatever reason. Another is that it is the spirit of the oceans that has ventured out onto the land. Then there is the legend of Perutha's god punishing us for all we have done wrong to her. Another is that it is nature paying us back for rushing entropy to its fruition, responded Isaac Nortino. What is your meaning? Asked Dr. Josiah, perplexed by Isaac Nortino's last statement as he helped himself to what looked like a piece of toast and started to place a piece of Jibna cheese on it. We have reached the maximum value of entropy on Perutha that we are able to manipulate, responded Isaac Nortino. We have totally mixed and randomized the top 6 feet of Perutha's crust. But on our approach to Perutha, we observed a beautiful sight. It was shining like a diamond with other diamonds floating and surrounding it. If my understanding of entropy is correct, that represents a very low value of entropy, does it not? Countered Dr. Josiah. What you observed on your advance was an artificial shell of sun-absorbing panels that our people depended on for energy, and the floating diamonds were satellites to augment the collection of energy, responded Isaac Nortino. Excuse me, Mr. Isaac, but what is a satellite? Asked Dr. Josiah. It is a sun-absorbing object that we are able to put into orbit around Perutha, of which we have many orbiting at the moment, responded Isaac Nortino. If the sun-absorbing panels surround the whole of Perutha, how do your plants grow? I mean, wheat requires the rays of the sun in order to grow and produce grain. Where do you get the wheat for the bread I hold in my hand? Asked Dr. Josiah. As I stated before, the surface of Perutha is no longer able to support plant life because it has reached the highest value of entropy by the advance of industry. You see, we were on a quest of clean energy for our industries, and the advances in sun collection panels know-how outcompeted plants. At that point, we had a choice. Either keep the primitive plants or go with the more efficient and advanced sun-absorbing panels. The problem of finding a way to make food was simple, and our industrial might came to the rescue and made it possible to create our own food, responded Isaac Nortino. Who made the decision to go with the sun-absorbing panels instead of allowing plants to continue to exist? Asked Dr. Josiah. Our governing body, the Brainotratics, made that decision, responded Isaac Nortino. On what basis did it make that choice? Asked Dr. Josiah. It was a simple matter of observing the obvious. The direction of the universe was to a higher value of entropy, in which plants would eventually not exit. The governing body humbly took a shortcut to the inevitable. Besides, our industries were more efficient at achieving max entropy in a shorter time frame by dispersing the surface of Perutha to greater distances when compared to the primitive plants and animals, responded Isaac Nortino. Dr. Josiah extracted the toast-looking object from his lips and placed it on his plate. He realized he had been eating artificial food for the past 2 days. No wonder I was having trouble in the bathroom, he muttered to himself. What was that, doctor? Inquired Isaac Nortino as he heard Dr. Josiah's muttering. Oh, nothing really, he replied. I heard something, said Isaac Nortino. You said something about the bathroom. It was nothing, said Dr. Josiah, and he tried to change the subject by adding, with regard to the plants and animals that lived on Perutha, how did they fare? I mean, did they all die suddenly? They lingered on with the help of backwards-looking plant and animal lovers for a while. They claimed they were creating a sustainable way to maintain the primitive, but their numbers shrank, and before the very end, the flora and fauna were only found in menageries that eventually had to be closed because of the lack of space and paying customers, responded Isaac Nortino. You mentioned that your sun-collecting panels outcompeted plants. What exactly was the competition in? Asked the doctor. The competition was in the ability to collect and store the sun's energy, answered Isaac Nortino. What is the evidence for that? I mean, how did you measure energy? asked the doctor. You see, Dr. Josiah, we were running our industries on substances found in the ground. At the same time, we were able to run some of our industries on another form of energy called electricity. We also discovered a way to collect and store electricity captured from the sun. We realized the sun would exist forever, and so we decided to switch to it as the source of our power in achieving maximum entropy allowable on Perutha, answered Isaac Nortino. You did not answer my question. How did you figure this electricity of yours was more efficient than plants? Repeated the doctor. We discovered plants were 0.04% efficient, and the sun collection panels were greater than 10%. That means we can achieve higher values of entropy by about 100 times than using primitive plants, responded Isaac Nortino as he continued to down his lunch. How about the fishes? Do you have oceans and seas in which they live? Asks the captain. Chapter 9. The Krell. Oh, we call them Samak, those creatures who inhabited the waterways. They are all gone now, responded Isaac Nortino. What happened to them? Asked the captain. The same as the plants and animals. They could not compete, replied Isaac Nortino. You mean they could not produce electricity? Inquired the captain. Not exactly. Much of the raw materials that goes into making our foods come from the oceans and seas, answered Isaac Nortino. You mean you ate all the fish? Exclaimed the captain. Isaac Nortino laughed out loud. No, no, it was not like that at all. Yes, we were eating fish at first, but when our industries took off and started to make our food a lot faster and cheaper from the krell of the oceans, all fish disappeared. How can that be? Inquired the captain. The krell are such an insignificant part of the waterways. The governing body made a study of why the fish disappeared, and found out that our efforts to be healthy and vital broke the chain of life in the oceans and seas. You see, in the springtime, the ocean waters well up carrying rich quantities of minerals from the ocean floors. The krell incorporate these minerals and, in turn, are food for many fish chains in the oceans, responded Isaac Nortino. You keep bringing up these chains of fish? What the heck are these chains? Asked the captain. You see, the krell are a very small creature that is eaten by fish, and these fish are in turn eaten by larger fish, and so forth until you get to the very large fish. The sequence of fish eating fish from the smallest to the largest is called a chain, and there are many such sequences or chains in the oceans, returned Isaac Nortino. I am getting confused. Then what is this? Asked the captain as he pointed his knife at the body of a fish on his plate. That is a flounder you are eating. It is made by our machines from oils we find in the ground, and also from other materials our machines find in krell, replied Isaac Nortino. Is it not delectable? Captain Whipple's knife drops from his hand onto the floor as his jaw drops about an inch or two from his face. That does not make any sense, exclaims Dr. Josiah. That does not sound efficient to me. How can you do away with the actual fish, yet reconstitute them by your machines at a cheaper price? I know it does not sound feasible to you, but if you consider the amount of time and energy it takes to naturally grow and catch fish from the oceans, the equation starts to make sense. Fish have to eat, and the source of their food is essentially the sun, and it is converted at an efficiency of 0.04%. The rest of the energy is not utilized. In addition, each link in the fish chain is less than 50% efficient. When you consider the fact that our machines are over 10% energy efficient, and the capture of the oil and krell at its source and not down the chain, you must immediately realize the advantage of using machines to make our foodstuffs, answered Isaac Nortino. Dr. Josiah immediately exclaims, How do you make the machines you use to make your foodstuffs? They must cost a lot to produce. I am sorry. Yes, you are right. Some machines produce the machines that make our foodstuffs. It does cost to build the machines, so their efficiency would be better expressed as 1.0%, which is much better than the primitive world of 0.04% efficiency, responds Isaac Nortino. But who makes the machines that make the machines? I mean, aren't there people involved and they also cost, don't they? Asked Dr. Josiah. You are right. When you interject the people who make the machines, the efficiency argument becomes more complex and harder to understand. On the other side of the equation, if you take into consideration entropy, you find the involvement of people adds to its value. The more people who make machines get involved, the higher the value of entropy, adds Isaac Nortino. You lost me again, said Dr. Josiah. You see, people and their machines, and the machines made by machines, all require Perutha's surface and oceans to be churned to manufacture the resources to keep them alive and running. The products made by the machines in service to Perutha's people are in turn disseminated throughout Perutha. These activities contribute to the mixing of Perutha's surface and an increase to the value of its entropy, responds Isaac Nortino. The governing body encouraged an increase in the reproductive activities of Perutha's people to further add to the increase of Perutha's entropy value. The population of people increased exponentially for about 100 years until it reached 9 billion individuals, added Isaac Nortino. Excuse me, Mr. Isaac, but what is a billion? Asked the captain. It is a large magnitude of a number, he responded. The captain counted on his fingers the consecutive magnitude of numbers that he knew of, which ended at 1 million. He understood 1 million had 6 zeros and could not imagine a number greater than that. How many zeros does 1 billion have after the number 9? He asked. It has 9 zeros, Captain, replied Isaac Nortino. The three visitors gasped. Where are these people? Where are the machines they made? Asked Dr. Josiah as he cleaned his monocle. Chapter 10. The Immune System. They have all perished, responded Isaac Nortino. My daughter and myself are the only ones left. The three visitors again were in shock and speechless. How come? Exclaimed the captain after a minute of silence. It was all started by the medical profession that thought it had a better tool to combat illness than the human body's immune system, said Isaac Nortino. What is this immune system? Asked Dr. Josiah. The human body has a system for combating illness, and it is called the immune system. You see, when you have a winter cold, the immune system fights back and eventually makes a person well again, responded Isaac Nortino. That is impossible. Throughout the medical profession's history, there was no organ identified as combating disease. Where does this system reside in the human body, sir? Inquired Dr. Josiah. It is invisible to the naked eye, doctor, but you have caught glimpses of it in what is called pus. This immune system is part of the blood complex that is generated in the bone marrow, replied Isaac Nortino. Horse feathers, pus is the infection, not the cure, said Dr. Josiah. I can see we will have difficulty getting past this point. For the sake of moving on with my description of what had happened to the 9 billion people on Perutha, let's assume there is an immune system and its existence will become clearer as I describe events, explained Isaac Nortino. I will let you carry on just this once, Mr. Isaac, agreed the doctor. In any population, there are skin problems, one of which is a scab-like hindrance found in some people, and it was discovered if the medical profession shuts off parts of the immune system, the scab-like skin disappears. This was a godsend for these people affected by this skin condition, because when it came to social interactions, appearance and presentation were so important, continued Isaac Nortino. It sounds improbable to me. How did they shut off part of the so-called immune system? Asked Dr. Josiah. They devised chemicals that did just that. These chemicals were either taken by mouth or introduced into the bloodstream directly, replied Isaac Nortino. So what? How did that result in the demise of the 9 billion people? Asked the doctor. At first, it did not. The problem with this method of manipulating the immune system was it left its subjects vulnerable to one or more of many diseases found in our populations, of which there were approximately 80. As the technology of immune suppression advanced, the vulnerability of its subjects increased, and it was necessary to figure out how to combat those often deadly consequences, answered Isaac Nortino. How did they do that? Asked Dr. Josiah. By the use of remedies, of course. There you go again with your fancy terminologies. Can you explain what you mean by remedies? Questioned Dr. Josiah. They are chemicals that weaken or eliminate the diseases in question, answered Isaac Nortino. That would be a godsend if they were able to achieve that goal. Just imagine a world with no diseases. How did they do that? Exclaimed Dr. Josiah. I am glad you are impressed. They devised 80 treatments for these 80 diseases, answered Isaac Nortino. Wow, I would like to know what these medicines are made of so we can implement a similar technique for fighting our diseases, responded Dr. Josiah. Don't be so much in a hurry, Dr. Josiah. These medicines had many harmful side effects, said Isaac Nortino. What do you mean? What is a side effect? Asked the doctor. It is an unintentional effect on the human body of one or more of the chemicals used in producing the remedies. In addition, the weakening of the immune system resulted in the appearance of all kinds of unexpected diseases, answered Isaac Nortino. If this was the case, why did not the governing organization put a stop to all this? Asked the doctor. All these medical activities were increasing the value of entropy of the Perutha. All took place in the research and production of these chemicals caused a tremendous mixing and dispersal of matter on its surface. This was in line with the prime directive of increasing the value of entropy, retorted Isaac Nortino. So, what happened? Asked the doctor. All kinds of warts, inflammations, and other conditions, as well as more dangerous cancers, appeared, but it was in line with the prime directive. These results were accepted as the norm in everyday life, and the price we had to pay in the name of progress, answered Isaac Nortino. So was this the reason all the people perished? Asked the doctor. Oh, not so. These unexpected diseases were a costly burden for sure, but they alone were not the cause of the wholesale decimation of human life, replied Isaac Nortino. Then what else caused the massive decline in your population? Asked Dr. Josiah. Chapter 11, Electricity. After lunch, Isaac Nortino decided not to answer the doctor's question right away, and instead invited the three visitors to his control room. Dr. Josiah was a little upset, but was over it as he entered with his cohorts, and Caledoria, a large and grand chamber, after traversing a maze of tunnels. It was dome-shaped with a covered hole at the top and a platform right under it on the floor of the chamber. This platform was full of what looked like cupboards with all kinds of knobs protruding from it. Look, gentlemen, from this platform I control all the electricity on the planet. At my fingertips are these levers and buttons that allow me to direct the flow and storage of all the energy-collecting sun panels you perceived on your way down to Perutha. This includes the sun energy-collecting satellites you observed orbiting Perutha, said Isaac Nortino as he took his seat at the cupboard with the controls. I'm having a hard time imagining what electricity is exactly, exclaimed Dr. Josiah. It is like a flowing river or stream on which you place a paddle wheel used in grinding grain. Electricity is much like the water in the river that is able to do work. The paddle wheel is like our machines that use the current to turn and create products. The only difference is electricity's current is in the cables you see around, such as that one, pointed Isaac Nortino to what looked like a rope on the floor. You mean you have these cables scattered all around the planet connecting? Asked Dr. Josiah. Yes, and they are all connected to a series of batteries and capacitors, replied Isaac Nortino. Oh gosh, here you go again with your fancy terms we don't understand. What are batteries and capacitors? Asked the doctor. A battery and a capacitor are devices to store electricity for later use, answered Isaac Nortino. But if you and your daughter are the only ones left on Perutha, what are you going to do with all these electricity devices? Asked Dr. Josiah. That is a very good question, responded Isaac Nortino. It is my hope to kill Zactulum with all the electricity I have gathered after first revealing what it looks like and is made of. So far I have realized Zactulum is beyond being approached, let alone killed. How do you propose to identify it and then kill it? Inquired Dr. Josiah. I have 198 gigawatts of electricity at my disposal, which I hope is enough to kill it. And as I am killing it, my hope is the electricity is enough to light it up so that we can observe and figure out what it is, reacted Isaac Nortino. I will let it go that 198 gigawatts of electricity is a gigantic quantity and would kill the Zactulum, but how are you going to deliver it to the beast? Questioned Dr. Josiah. I have set a trap, replied Isaac Nortino. A trap? Where is this trap located? Asked Dr. Josiah. It is on the surface of the planet, responded Isaac Nortino as he pointed up to the covered hole at the top of the... Up there. You see the platform I am on will rise and the cover will open, exposing me to the beast. Isn't that dangerous? Asked Dr. Josiah. Yes, it is dangerous. I will be the bait that attracts Zactulum. He and I have been adversaries for a long time. From my days as a child with my parents, Lunda and Gurump, May they rest in peace, who taught me how to avoid Zaktulam by hiding in these tunnels to the day he took my wife and soulmate, Helomaya, to heaven, responded Ezek Nortino as he leaned on his cane, head down, and a tear dropped from his right eye onto his shoe. I am sorry to hear about Helomaya. How did it happen? Asked Dr. Josiah. At that time there was a platform but no domed chamber. We had to devise a way to attract Zaktulam so I could deliver the electricity shock to kill it. But I could not be in two places at the same time. It was out there and the control platform was inside. At first we tried effigies of myself placed outside, but they failed to attract the fiend. We figured it needed a scent, so we dressed the model in my soiled clothes, but that failed too. I then volunteered to be the live bait while Helomaya operated the controls, but she was afraid she would make a mistake and shock me instead. In the end, she insisted that she be the bait and I take the controls since I am an expert at operating them, explained Ezek Nortino as he started to choke up. After a moment of silence, Dr. Josiah put his arm around Ezek Nortino's shoulders, trying to comfort him. She then rushed outside the tunnel and stood in between the electrodes in plain sight, waiting for the monster. As I followed its footsteps that made impressions in the lifeless and powdery ground approaching her, I waited until I guessed where it was with respect to the electrodes, and before I knew it, she was snatched away. Ezek Nortino and Caledoria sobbed openly now, and he could not continue. They all returned to the sleeping chamber and settled down for the evening without eating dinner. Each entered their cavity and tried to sleep. Dr. Matthew had no trouble when he entered Caledoria's cavity at that time. Chapter 12. The Consoler. He lay next to her, on his back with his arms on his chest for a moment, then turned towards her, put his left arm around her, and said in a soft voice, I am truly sorry about your mom. She turned on her side towards him and said, Hold me tight, and don't let me go. He put his right arm under her neck and held her closer for the longest time. Do you still have your mother, doctor? She asked as she combed his hair with her fingers. Yes, but she lives far away in Ireland. Please call me Matt, he responded. Where do you live, Matt? She inquired. I live in the America colony of New Hampshire, he answered. How far is that from Ireland? She asked. Well, that is a hard question. It takes anywhere from 2 to 3 months for letters to make it from Ireland to New Hampshire, he responds. That is a long time. It must be hard on you not to have your mother closer by, she countered. Yes, it was, but I chose to migrate. I offered to have her come with me to New Hampshire, but she would not. She explained the rest of the family was there, and so were her friends, he added. Would you consider returning to Earth with me when I leave Perutha? Matt asked. Why do you ask? She asked back. I have serious feelings for you, don't you know? He said. Don't you think I would be out of place on your Earth? She asked. What do you mean? He came back. I do look differently than you with your little cauliflower ears. I mean, don't all Earthlings look the same having small ears? She answers. Yes, we do, but I don't think that should matter. I mean, I will protect you if anyone says or tries to do anything, he replied, and then he kissed her. I don't know. I still feel my place is on Perutha and with my father, she said. But you are the last woman on the Perutha. You will have no one to be with when, heaven forbid, your father passes away, he said. You don't understand, do you? You are the type of person who feels unattached to any one place. That is why you migrated to New Hampshire, leaving everything familiar behind. I am married to the world I am on here and now, a world I feel comfortable in, she explained as she started to pull away from him. I am sorry for pressing you on this point. It is just that I am falling for you, he said as he drew her nearer to him. Her ears started to flutter and she stopped resisting. Well, stay away from me because I am not going anywhere, she said. Come on now, I know you at least have some feelings for me, he insisted. What gave you that idea, she asked. The way you hold me and make love to me, he said. I have never made love to you, she looks at him surprised. Yes, you have, and he kissed her. Her ears fluttered again as she drew him near. Chapter 13. The Extinctions. At breakfast on the third day of the three visitors' stay, Ezek Nortino remembered Dr. Josiah's inquiry about what else caused the massive decline in Perutha's human population. please pass the butter," he continued. As I recall, I had talked about advances in the treatment of the human immune system at lunch yesterday as one of the causes of the extinction of the humans on our planet. Next came the mystery of the masses of birds that would simply drop dead from the sky in the middle of flight. "What do you mean, drop dead from the sky? What caused this to happen?" asked Dr. Josiah. "No one knows," he responded. "Surely there are theories?" inquired Dr. Josiah. "Yes, there are many theories. One such scheme was based on competition in the advancement of entropy. It was long believed birds were the most efficient creatures in entropy's progress. You see, birds spread seed, feces, and feathers all over the place in the quickest way possible. As the theory goes, a group of humans conspired to be the most efficient by killing off all birds with laser beams and taking up the dissemination of matter by creating the transportation sector of the economy." Ezek Nortino was interrupted by Dr. Josiah, who asked, "What do you mean by transportation sector?" "I mean, back on Earth, we have hundreds of ships and thousands of horses, which I gather is not what you are suggesting. I am not familiar with what you have on your Earth, but at the height of our industrialization, there were 100 million or more vehicles that operated on fuel oils, which rivaled the hundreds of billions of birds in the advancement of entropy," added Ezek Nortino. "Surely, that would not have caused the end of the human race on Perutha," exclaimed Dr. Josiah. "No, it did not," returned Ezek Nortino. "Soon after the birds disappeared, all bees and other bugs also perished. The theories behind this included the accumulation of toxic emissions from our industrialized societies. These societies competed to advance the value of Perutha's entropy value. These toxins existed in large pockets of air close to the ground that affected insects. Once the bugs disappeared, crops started to fail, and food became scarce for backward-looking people who depended on them, which led to their deaths," responded Ezek Nortino. "What do you mean by backward-looking people?" asked Dr. Josiah. "These are people who thought the old ways of the primitives were the way to live. They existed in groups of 10 or 20 individuals and roamed the ancient jungles, subsisting on what they could find from native growths. They were practicing zero entropy by all measures," answered Ezek Nortino. "I am assuming this occurred before the advent of the sun collecting panels that outcompeted plants," commented Dr. Josiah. "You are correct," returned Ezek Nortino. "I would guess by about 50 years or so. I may add here, the terrestrial fauna and flora disappeared about the same time when the sun collecting panels took over the job of providing for humans what once was provided by aquatic and terrestrial life." "Surely, this was a great tragedy," insisted Dr. Josiah. "No, not really," answered Ezek Nortino. "You see, it was all inevitable. Entropy was to advance whether we liked it or not. It was all a matter of us all jumping on the bandwagon and embracing it. Sure, our bodies resisted the predictable, but our minds took over and accepted our fate. I still think it is a tragedy. What is wrong with slowing down the inevitable and allowing what once existed on Perutha to continue?" asked Dr. Josiah. "We convinced ourselves time was the enemy and have actually made the world a kinder and gentler place. We estimated the number of deaths on Perutha would have been exponentially greater if we had not speeded up the process. You see, at the current expedited pace, the number of deaths will be about 100 billion humans in about 10 years. If we slow the process of increasing entropy by 50%, the number of human deaths will be 1,000 kajillion, since the humans will continue to reproduce and die for 20 years until Perutha reaches the same entropy value. The same goes for the rest of the fauna and flora. So if we do not speed up the process, we will have much blood on our hands," replied Ezek Nortino. "That is absurd," responded Dr. Josiah, and Dr. Matthew agreed with him, as well as the captain, by nodding their heads. "You have so far explained how Perutha was denuded of its fauna and flora except for the humans. How did they all go and why?" Chapter 14, The Race to the End. The three visitors, Calidoria and Ezek Nortino, proceeded to the colossal humming chamber for a drink before lunch, when Dr. Matthew inquired how they could tell when the day started or ended when there were no windows in the maze of tunnels they traversed while awake. "There are tubes that go from the tunnels up to the surface. Jutak, our robot, checks for the source of light from these tubes and punctuates our days and nights that way, responds Isaac Nortino. For example, there is a tube that can tell when early evening has come, and he sounds the bell for serving dinner. Where are these tubes located? Asked Dr. Matthew. Follow me, responded Isaac Nortino as he walked to a domed door a little distance from behind the couch. As he opened it, the three visitors could see a machine with six arms and no head, busy washing dishes. They entered the room and saw bright spots on the floor all in a row. Spots at both ends were considerably fainter than the one in the middle. It must be noon, said Isaac Nortino as he pointed to that middle one. As they all saluted each other with glasses filled with some sort of juice, Dr. Josiah asked, I would like to get back to how all 9 billion people died, if you would please, as he looked at Isaac Nortino. Ah, yes, there was one fact overlooked by the Misihia beliefs and the Brainotratics form of government, indicated Isaac Nortino as he stopped to think. What might that be, Mr. Isaac? Asked Dr. Josiah as he pushed for a fast answer. It was the fact of genetics, responded Isaac Nortino. What do you mean by genetics? Inquired Dr. Josiah, who did not know what that term meant. I am sorry, genetics is a term used to describe the effects of inheritance or bloodlines. I realize now it is a modern term not yet used by you, reacted Isaac Nortino. Okay, what does inheritance have to do with beliefs or forms of government? Asked Dr. Josiah. It has to do with our ancestors. Our primitive ancestors, to be exact, and the way they evolved. Isaac Nortino responded. Evolved? What do you mean? Queried Dr. Josiah. I beg your pardon. I'm having a difficult time here with the concept of race and its effects on the demise of the people of this planet, complained Isaac Nortino. We are familiar with the concept of race, Mr. Isaac. Please go on, Dr. Josiah in response. Very well, both Misihia beliefs and the Brainotratics form of governments had as a central theme the unity of its countries or societies. However, the Industrial Revolutions created counties of mixed races with millions or even billions of individuals. This created a great challenge, stated Isaac Nortino. Why did that create a challenge, Mr. Isaac? Countered Dr. Josiah. It has to do with the fact that each individual has a primitive affinity for its kind or race. And as industries competed, the populations started to form racial divides, which made it extremely hard to keep counties in one piece. Eventually, the whole globe descended into racial wars that concluded in the inhalation of all except for the Trazinos, replied Isaac Nortino. How did the Trazinos prevail? I mean, what advantage did they have over the others? Asked Dr. Josiah. The Trazinos invented something called artificial intelligence. With this artificial intelligence, they learned over time the behaviors of the other human races and were able to formulate ways to defeat them with little effort through cunning and swiftness in battle, answered Isaac Nortino. Dr. Josiah countered with, Doesn't this oppose the advancement of the value of entropy on your planet? I mean, with a reduction in the population to one race means a reduction in the degree of achieving higher entropy. Not at all. You see, the racial wars caused a major upheaval of Perutha's upper crust due to all the exploding munitions and bombardments. This in itself caused a major increase of entropy and speeded up the inevitable, returned Isaac Nortino. Then what happened to the Trazinos if they were the last to survive the racial wars? Asked Dr. Josiah. They perished due to a microbe, or should I say a fast-moving disease called Rowana, they had no clue existed. You see, their immune system was so compromised by their manipulations, they were not able to naturally combat Rowana, nor were they able to devise a vaccine in time, so they all vanished, replied Isaac Nortino. So, from where do you and your daughter come into the picture? Asked Dr. Josiah. Chapter 15, Reflections of Mr. Nortino. Isaac Nortino put his feet up on the table that was in front of the couch and said, Caledoria, my parents, Helomaya and I were from a primitive tribe that roamed the jungles of equatorial Perutha. It is a lost world now. We were captured and made slaves of one of the Trazinos families. Our immune systems were not compromised, and so we survived the Rowana disease pandemic. Ah, so did you live through all the race wars? Asked Dr. Josiah. Yes, the race wars lasted for approximately 30 years. Caledoria was born towards the middle of those wars, replied Isaac Nortino. I bet therefore you hold the great bag of wisdom that we were brought here to learn from, commented Dr. Matthew as he took another sip of juice. I don't know whether to call what I have to say wisdom, but it is my take on the story of Perutha from my eyes to your ears, if you care to listen, comments Ezek Nortino. We are listening, said Dr. Josiah, as all three visitors leaned forward in their seats intent on listening. First of all, humans are but one link in the proverbial chain of beings on Perutha that make up its organosphere. All links are vital to this sphere. Each link needs to be healthy and strong for the chain as a whole to function properly. If only one link is broken, the whole chain will unravel and collapse as it has on Perutha, Ezek Nortino emphasized. He then went on and said, humans are not more intelligent than any other being on Perutha. Intelligence is a function of how the being perceives itself in the environment. The being in question needs to realize it is a part of the whole and not apart from it. It needs to respect all other links. Humans have no right to claim Perutha as their own, to do whatever they want with it. They must realize that Perutha is the temple in which they must pay respect to the whole chain that they are a part of. They can't own the temple, but they must bow to it and cleanse themselves before entering it. Humans are not capable of managing themselves. They must take wisdom from nature, which does not care about wealth or power, but appreciates simplicity. Simplicity in how we treat each other. Simplicity in how we treat other beings and things. Humans need to realize the sun is the source of all energy on Perutha. It is the source of its rhythm. It is the source of its balance in the dance of all life, concludes Ezek Nortino. That sure is a mouthful, but where is the mention of entropy? It seems to me you are promoting a slower advance in its accumulation, commented Dr. Josiah. That is true, Dr. Scheib. I am promoting the extended enjoyment by your Earth's life forms of an endless sunrises and sunsets. I am enamored by the natural pace of entropy on your planet, added Ezek Nortino. What about the endless multitude of deaths that will be caused by a slower entropy progression, as you had mentioned earlier, questioned Dr. Josiah. Your Earth is ever-changing and evolving. Each sunrise and sunset are different. And so death is the price we pay for the precious birth in each new iteration, explained Ezek Nortino. That is hard to believe. Our Earth does not change as you say it does, exclaimed Dr. Josiah. But it must, Doctor. It has to be changing at such a slow entropy pace it is not perceptible, explained Ezek Nortino. Just then a siren sounded, and Ezek Nortino jumped up and hobbled quickly to the dome chamber, followed by the three visitors and Caledoria. Chapter 16. The Reckoning. Ezek Nortino stepped up to the control platform and started to move the levers and pressed buttons. The platform started to rise up to the top of the dome where the trap door opened, and he emerged onto the dead surface out of sight of his audience below. He saw the footprints of Zach Tulum that made deep impressions in the lifeless soil. Again, he estimated where the head of the beast should be. At what he thought was the right moment, he was devoured by Zach Tulum, just as he pressed the control that delivered the presumed lethal shock of 198 gigawatts of electricity, and it, the beast, became visible. It was about 300 feet tall, with two heads and 12 arms. One head had a mouth with 10-foot fangs, and the other head's mouth was chewing Ezek Nortino. 198 gigawatts of electricity was not enough to kill Zach Tulum. As the charge dissipated, Zach Tulum became invisible again, and it started to roar at an unbelievable pitch and trashed everything in sight. It also started to dig deep into the ground to find the tunnels in which the three shocked visitors and uncontrollably sobbing Caledoria were hiding. The captain took control of the situation and ordered them to follow him through the tunnels. But Caledoria would not go and preferred to stay where she could look for her father. The three arrived at the spaceship that had its ramp down. The captain was the first on board, followed by Dr. Josiah. Dr. Matthew kept looking back at the tunnels to see if Caledoria changed her mind. His two cohorts kept yelling for him to climb aboard. Finally, he realized he had to go, and the tears started to well up in his eyes. His heart was pounding hard now, and he reluctantly turned around to head to the spaceship. Unfortunately, he had a hard time moving his legs. As he started to laboriously climb up the ramp, a hand touched his shoulder. It was Caledoria. He tried to wipe the tears from his eyes to make sure it was her as she said, "Take me." He then grabbed her hand and they both rushed aboard. The captain looked at the levers on the control table in the command room and figured out how to start and maneuver the spaceship back to Earth. Chapter 17, Back on Earth. The spaceship stopped at the fishing cabin and they descended the ramp. After they got onto the cabin's deck, the spaceship wobbled and slowly sank into the lake as they watched. The three gentlemen knew they had some explaining to do, and in particular Dr. Matthew, who now had a companion. They huddled in the cabin and realized they had to come up with a fictitious story since the truth was so unbelievable. They agreed they were called to Boston for an emergency meeting of the Massachusetts Colony's Freedom Party. They also agreed that Caledoria had lost her husband in a shipwreck at sea, and Dr. Matthew arranged to take her in since she had no one in Boston to take care of her. They also gave her the name of Mrs. Smith. Each departed their own way that evening. Mrs. Smith wore a gunny sack over her skin-tight suit and a fishing net over her ears as she accompanied Dr. Matthew to his clinic on Front Street. After getting situated upstairs in his living quarters, he left to get Angoli, whom he had left with Mrs. Jake Andrew of Jake's Mercantile next door. As Angoli entered the apartment, Mrs. Smith tried to touch elbows with her and said, "Hello, Lady Bellingham," but Angoli did not know what to do when she saw the elephant ears and hid behind Dr. Matthew. After he set the record straight as to who was who, the sleeping arrangement had to be sorted out. It took a long time arguing back and forth, and finally, Mrs. Smith and Angoli agreed, took his bed, and he slept on the couch. But none slept that night. The couch was too short for the doctor. Angoli was suspicious of Mrs. Smith's ears, and Mrs. Smith felt out of place. The next morning, he rushed down to Jake's Mercantile, purchased a couple of bonnets that would cover Mrs. Smith's ears, and explained to her that people would not understand if they saw them and to wear one at all times. 2 days later, the Rabid Dog's Leg meeting took place in the fishing cabin on Parsons Lake. Dr. Josiah took his place on the inverted bucket in the corner while the captain and Dr. Matthew stood up and hung on ropes dangling from the ceiling. "What did you think of our travel to Perutha, Captain?" The captain replied, "I think it was a waste of time. I mean, it was like a dream, so strange." "I thought it had some credibility," added Dr. Matthew. "I mean, it showed us how not to form a government such as the one described by Isaac Nortino." "What did he call it?" he asked. "Brainatratics was what it was called," responded Dr. Josiah. "The idea is imaginative, to say the least, and has some merit. I believe it got around the politicking that goes on here and in England. It had a purpose, which was the increase of entropy. But our societies are more complex than those he described on Perutha. I will have to agree that type of government is not for us in the colonies. So where does that leave us?" "I would agree with Dr. Matthew. The journey to Perutha taught us how not to form a government. So now we are back to square one. As for the concept of entropy, I think it is buffalo chips from beginning to end," added the captain. "Yes, I agree," said Dr. Matthew. "All that the concept of entropy did was destroy Perutha. I agree with Dr. Josiah that our people are smarter and deserve a better governing body that considers that. I don't believe people want to destroy what they had or created. I see our country building, creating, producing, and serving the needs of the people. The kernel of our intent is to build, not destroy." Chapter 18, The Signing. Early on June 15, 1776, the three space travelers met downtown New Hampshire and boarded the traveling coach to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It was a long journey that took them a week of time, during which they discussed the types of government they would vote for when the time came. Dr. Josiah started the conversation by asking the other two, "Would you vote for a monotheistic government?" The captain responded with, "Heck, not in my lifetime." "I agree with the captain," said Dr. Matthew. "We have too much of a mixture of faiths in the colonies for that to be successful." "Then what do you propose, Captain?" asked Dr. Josiah. "The old world has had a good long run of kingdoms. Maybe we need to pick a king," responded the captain. "I will have to disagree," countered Dr. Matthew. "Kingdoms promote volatility and wars." The conversation continued back and forth until they checked into the Alberta Grand Hotel. at which time all three agreed on the form of government they would vote for. They met other dignitaries to discuss the matter at the Pennsylvania State House, and on July 4, 1776, participated in signing the Declaration of Independence of the 13 colonies from England, after which they contributed to the writing of the Constitution of the United States. Chapter 19. The Waterfall Garden. The period was 1 year later, in 1777. The War of Independence of the United States of America from the British had started. The Reverend Stofield started the sermon that day with the following excerpt from Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he, him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to every thing that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. He went on to expound on the thought that the colonies rightfully belonged to its settlers, and not the King of England. Angoli and Caledoria sat in silence. Angoli was still learning the language, so she didn't understand much, and Caledoria often shook her head as the Reverend went on with his arguments. After the sermon was over, and the parishioners filed out the church south of Portsmouth, Angoli and Caledoria walked down a path to their favorite place in the forest, where Caledoria helped Angoli learn English. It was around a pond in the middle of the woods that was fed by water from a waterfall from a branch of the Sagemont Creek. The clearing around the pond was a natural garden for flowers and ferns, where Caledoria and Angoli spent many an hour talking about their faraway worlds that they missed so much. There was also a hideout at the back behind the waterfall, in which they pretended to be invisible and watched the wildlife as it passed by, such as deer to wolves, squirrels, and chipmunks. There were ducks and geese that landed in the pond to take a rest when flying north. They often left food out for their menagerie of animals to entice them to stay a while. One Sunday, when they approached the pond from behind some trees, they noticed someone bathing, which made them stop in their tracks. It was an Indian woman with long black straight hair held in place by a leather strap who splashed herself as she washed her buckskin attire with a stone and as she sat on a large rock. Around those parts of the colony, the Penacook Indians made their territory, but it was unusual for any of them to come this close to the town of Portsmouth. Angoli and Caledoria thought they would retreat to town to leave her alone. As they started back towards town, they decided to investigate. They went back to the spot where they saw her, and stood there for a few minutes, then Angoli pulled on Caledoria's sleeve, and they both moved into the clearing. The Indian woman suddenly saw them, and started to gather her wash, when both Angoli and Caledoria raised their palms in a sign of peace. As the Indian saw that they were women without any male companions, she yelled, "Intum bedamilo ehenna?" The two did not understand what the Indian had just said, and Caledoria responded with, "We mean you no harm." "What are you doing here?" asked the Indian. "We come here every Sunday to be alone, talk and learn English," responded Caledoria. "I see you speak English." "Yes, I do. The missionaries taught me. But why are you two here? This is Penacook Indian territory. You know you could be killed if found by my people," responded the Indian. "We did not know that. We are sorry for intruding. We will leave right now," responded Caledoria as she grabbed Angoli's hand. Just then, the Indian heard a rustling in the nearby bushes, and she told them to follow her as she ran behind the waterfall and took cover. The two followed her there, and all three huddled low as a white trapper entered the clearing and took a drink from the pond. A few minutes later, he left the area, and the three behind the waterfall started to feel a little at ease. "What is your name?" asked the Indian of Caledoria. "I am Caledoria," she responded. She then pointed to Angoli and said, "This is my sister Angoli, and we are from the town of Portsmouth." "I am Pentecote of the Gorbuk family that lives half a day's walk from here," responded the Indian. But you are a white woman and she is black. How can you be sisters? Pentacote added. We are sisters by a blood pact, Calidoria answered. What is the meaning of blood pact? Asked Pentacote. As they heard popping far away, Calidoria said, We cut our wrists and bound the wounds together for an hour so that our bloods mixed. This was how we became sisters. I must go now, said Pentacote as she started to dress up. Will we see you again, Pentacote? Asked Angoli. Before Pentacote could respond, she darted into the forest. I wonder what those exploding sounds were all about, asked Angoli as she held on to Calidoria's hand. Chapter 20 Monkeys. Angoli and Calidoria again met Pentacote at the waterfall after that first encounter. It was getting to be clear Pentacote liked the two blood sisters as well as they did her. On an August afternoon, they met and the discussion turned to the war that was going on. All they knew was that it was between the colonies and the British red coats, and not one of them felt about it one way or the other since it did not concern them directly. Reflecting on the war, Angoli said, In my homeland, there were many conflicts. They were for our territory and other tribes wanting to take it away from us. Pentacote and Calidoria nodded their heads in agreement. I used to watch the monkeys fight too. There was one type of monkey with a long snout, and the woman monkeys had a large red bottom at certain times. These monkeys reminded me of my tribe and the conflicts that came about. I used to watch their interactions and fighting. Are you interested for me to tell you what I think? Asked Angoli. Yes, go ahead, Angoli. It sounds interesting, but first explain to me what a monkey is. I have never heard of such a person, responded Pentacote, as Calidoria nodded her head. It is not a person, but a creature of the wild that has a tail. It stands about waist high and walks on its four legs, said Angoli. Anyway, they had a grand leader overall who was in their tribe. He had many ladies giving him children. He had underlings of men who had a better life than the other ordinary men. He would lead all men into battle against other similar monkeys that come into their feeding land. So they have acts of war. But as I know from what Dr. Matthew told me, the grand leaders in human wars stay behind and let the ordinary men do the fighting. I wonder why? Asked Calidoria. There was a silent moment and then Angoli said, Maybe because when the monkeys fight, no one dies. A lot get hurt. But no one dies. When the colonists and redcoats fight, there are many deaths. Just then, a screeching sound started to come closer and closer, and then a huge explosion occurred about 200 feet from where they were. It was a projectile from firing a cannon. All three rushed and hid behind the waterfall. They stayed there for a few minutes, and then Calidoria decided it was safe to go out again. But Angoli and Pentacote held on to her arms, insisting it was not safe yet. As they sat there breathing in the mist generated by the falling water on the rocks below, a troop of 12 redcoats holding rifles with bayonets deployed came rushing into the pond clearing. One of the soldiers who seemed to be the leader said, That was close. This place is not safe, so let us keep marching south until we meet up with our regiment. And they all filed in and headed south as quickly as they came. The three women stayed behind the waterfall for another half an hour in silence until they all felt safe and came out. The bombing had stopped by then, and they continued with their conversation. Angoli said, The fighting inside the monkey tribe created a hill of individuals where the top of the hill was the grand leader, and underneath him were the loyal first set of underlings, then the second set of underlings, until you reached the lowest of the low. Each man-monkey in the higher set had more ladies than the one set under him until you reached the lowest, who have no ladies at all. Angoli went on and said, This was similar to how my tribe acted. The difference was there was no pairing of ladies and men, nor was there marriage. The tribe was one family, and all people were cared for and loved by all others. There were no long-term sexual partners. There were no sexual partner rules except that brothers and sisters could not have sexual relations. Children recognize that all men are their fathers and all ladies are their mothers. All adults recognize the children of the tribe as their own. At night, a lady may pair or may not be paired with a man as a sleeping partner. The same goes for men. That was not to say that men or women did not have a favorite partner to sleep with for any length of time. A tear ran down Angoli's cheek as she remembered how it was growing up, and the men she had known who were still alive and those who perished. Pentacote and Caledoria tried to console her, but that just made her cry more. As they sat there holding each other, Dr. Matthew suddenly appeared in the pond clearing and yelled, "Caledoria, Angoli, come away from that Indian. You are late coming home. It is already dusk. What are you doing here?" "This is Pentacote, our friend," responded Caledoria, and as she turned around to point to Pentacote, Pentacote had already disappeared into the forest. The three headed towards Front Street. The Blood Sisters wondered if they would meet Pentacote again. Chapter 21, Perutha's War, Number 1. On the next Sunday, Caledoria and Angoli walked to the waterfall as usual after promising Dr. Matthew they would be back home by sundown. Of course, they were hoping Pentacote would be there, and she was. She was waiting for them sitting on a large rock dangling her feet in the water. Her curiosity was aroused by the monkey stories told by Angoli and wanted to hear more. The all adapted Caledoria's greeting method of touching elbows and decided to hide behind the waterfall, just in case someone not welcome sees them there. Caledoria sat with her legs crossed in the waterfall behind her, while Angoli and Pentacote rested their backs against the cave wall facing Caledoria, who spoke up and said, "Last time we were talking about war and the reason it comes about." "Yes, Caledoria, that is right," responded Pentacote. "Have you experienced war where you came from?" "Oh, yes. I have experienced many wars in my lifetime. The most famous war is that of the country of Kiatnan. You see, there was a power struggle between two giant counties on Perutha who had great conflict. These two counties had enormous stockpiles of massively destructive weapons, where the mere fact that if war erupted between them would certainly end life on Perutha as we knew it," answered Caledoria. "So what happened?" asked Pentacote. "Did they avert war, or did war erupt? Where does Kiatnan come into the picture?" Caledoria responded and said, "Kiatnan was split in two. There was East Kiatnan and West Kiatnan, which were actually one country at one time, that was split into two by the two superpowers, each taking one side under its influence. After a while, war erupted in Kiatnan. Apparently, they no longer wanted to be separated and decided to lean toward one of the superpowers in an attempt to fight the other for independence and unification. This did not sit well with the other superpower, and it set up a puppet government in West Kiatnan and claimed it was protecting it from East Kiatnan. The president of the superpower protecting West Kiatnan felt this was a good idea to let off steam from the bigger powder keg of superpower against superpower and the destruction of Perutha. The war continued for several years, in which millions of people were lost before Kiatnan was once again unified and war between the superpowers averted." Angoli at this point said, "You see, my idea of struggle over territory is how you can understand war." "What do you mean?" asked Pentacote. "Like the monkeys and my tribe's people, the fight between Perutha's superpowers was over territories," responded Angoli. Caledoria added here that there was a struggle for ideas like the struggle over territory. You see, the two superpowers had different ways of running governments and wealth distribution. One government believed in equal distribution of wealth among its citizens, while the other believed in uneven wealth distribution to allow for larger projects. I believe the ideas that float in a population are just as strong, if not stronger, than that of territory. Differences in ideas of the type you mentioned did not exist in my former world. Sure, we had belief systems that were different from one tribe to the next, and the differences were small, but they were of the kind that did not contribute to conflict," added Angoli. I will have to agree with Angoli on this. In our territories like that of the Concord tribe or the Pinnacook, there are differences of ideas, but they never cause conflict like conflicts over territories," added Pentacote. "Besides, we avoid conflict most of the time and try to settle territory disputes peacefully because conflict causes loss, which is not good. I will have to insist that differences of ideas do become the source of conflict and great loss," added Caledoria. "I have seen too much of it." "How so, Caledoria?" asked Pentacote. Angoli notices the dimming light outside the cave and suddenly yells, "It is getting late. We need to be back home soon. Let's go, Caledoria." Chapter 22, Perutha War, Number 2. Ongoli, Caledoria, and Pentacote met up with each other on the following Sunday and again hid behind the waterfall to watch the goings-on. While exchanging small talk, they could hear the high-pitched wheezing of musket projectiles passing through the vegetation around the pond. They stopped talking because they sensed something was going to happen. And sure, enough it did. They saw a young red coat helping one of the colonial militia soldiers hobble to the pond to get a drink of water. It looked like he had a problem with his leg, and more likely he was shot. They heard the redcoat tell the militia soldier that he must go and rejoin his regiment before they found out he was helping a militia soldier. As the redcoat ran towards the forest, he was also shot by a stray projectile, which hit him in the head, and he dropped immediately to the ground. The militia soldier hobbled over to where he was to check on him, but then the three saw him make the cross and surmised that the redcoat was dead. About a minute later, three redcoats showed up and saw the militia soldier standing over the dead redcoat. A commotion started and the militia soldier was stabbed in the neck by a bayonet from one of the redcoats and died. The redcoats then carried both bodies out of the pond area and disappeared into the forest. All three had to wipe the tears from their eyes and cheeks. Pentacote said, "This war has demonstrated the cruel intentions of people." "There is no limit to how cruel people can be," said Caledoria, who went on to say, "During the evolution of the race wars on Perutha, there was one conflict that demonstrated the effect of what people think. It was called the Weapons of Global Obliteration War, or the WGO War for short, on account it was over its possession. You see, there were 97 nations on Perutha and two superpowers. The superpowers reserved the right to own WGOs. The rest of the nations were denied such weapons, the reason being the two superpowers were more intelligent than the rest, and knew when and when not to use them," explained Caledoria. "That does not make sense to me," said Angoli. "This sounds more like my idea of the King of the Mountain. The two superpowers were the two highest peaks in the social order, and reserved the right to use the WGOs, and the rest simply went along." "I will have to agree with Angoli. All people are of equal intelligence, and to think otherwise is wrong. My tribe and the Concord tribe believe we are all intelligent beings. We just have different territories, that is all," said Pentacote. "Well, the WGO war started when one non-superpower country president insulted the president of a superpower. The superpower president took it upon himself to spread rumors that the non-superpower country had illegal WGOs, and he hired people to lie about it to the global public. No stone was left unturned to make the lie become reality to many, and without much resistance, the superpower invaded its intended victim. The end result was the devastation of the victim country. Approximately 10% of the population was killed off, and another 10% was displaced to other adjoining countries. The victim country's president had his head chopped off, which was presented to the superpower president as a souvenir. That was what it looked like on the surface. But underneath the lies were the facts that the two countries had opposing beliefs. The superpower believed in a god of prosperity, while it believed the other non-superpower believed in a god that would destroy humanity, and thus it deserved to be invaded," answered Caledoria. Chapter 23 Gods. "I'm getting confused. Are the origins of war explained by the King of the Mountain, the differences of ideas, or the faiths of nations?" asked Angoli. "I know. It is all these ideas combined. Isn't it, Caledoria?" asked Pentacote. Caledoria was silent for about 30 seconds and then slowly said, "I think Pentacote is right, but I think it goes much deeper. Both of your worlds are void of the devastating wars of my world, and therefore I think you two have the answers," responded Caledoria. "So, it's King of the Mountain idea," adds Angoli. "But where does what people think and faith fit into the picture?" "I introduced the concepts of faith and what people think. Where I came from, you cannot see or touch the god, and he only existed in our imagination. But in your case, he or she exists in the trees, in the forests that you can touch and feel, or in the waters that you drink," responded Caledoria. "You mean that the human imagination is the cause of wars?" asked Pentacote. "I guess so. You see, your ideas and your faiths are grounded in reality and nature. So, nature is in control of how you act and what you believe in, while the imagination of people in my world is under human control. Therefore, the people's imagination is controlling people. I guess I'm trying to say people are supposed to be managed by nature. People were meant to use simple tools for a down-to-earth life seeking simple pleasures, responded Caledoria. But how did it come about that people were controlled by their own imagination? Asked Angoli. That is a good question. Where I come from, people are very involved in their thoughts and problem-solving. Our God was an intangible entity that inflated the importance of self and was devoid of natural constraints that ushered in humanity's attempts to also manage nature, answered Caledoria. But where does war come into this concept of people controlling people? Asked Pentacote. You see, I was part of a warring faction called the Trezinos, whose imaginary God told them to go to war to defeat an enemy that was not of their bloodline, answered Caledoria. Chapter 24, Smartness. Caledoria, that is not the case here in my world. We believe that all are related. That includes the animals in the forest and the trees. Why is it that bloodlines cause wars in your world? Asked Pentacote. Problem-solving and the inflated self created an imaginary value system called smartness, where the creator is at the top of the scale. There is a problem with this measure, however. The inflated self helped remove people from reality. I don't think we can separate what people think from faith or bloodline in my world. They all caused wars. The value systems created only fulfilled the creator's need to think of his or herself as being better than others, and therefore justified in claiming that which is not his or hers, responded Caledoria. What are you trying to say, Caledoria? Inquired Pentacote. In your world, Pentacote, life is not as complicated as it is in my world. People are not more or less important, or for that matter, smarter than any other form of life. People are of equal smartness to all other forms of life. Yourself is controlled by the natural world you are in, as we had discussed and found out in a previous discussion. In the world I came from, the constraints on the self are imaginary and not natural, responded Caledoria. Chapter 25, The Chain of Life. The flawed observation caused by the self in my world is that people's lives are more important than any other form of life form has led people to think of themselves as at the highest point on the order of life, commented Caledoria. What are you talking about, Caledoria? Asked Angoli. Oh, my mind is wandering again. I was thinking about our last conversation regarding the imaginary gods in my world and how they affected our thoughts through the inflation of ourselves. Chains gave me an idea of how to express those ideas, explained Caledoria. I remember now. It is when people in your world started to govern themselves, acknowledged Angoli. People in my world thought of life as being like a chain, and had the mistaken idea that the order of life was simple, that the chain moved from top to bottom with maybe a few branches, and that the people were at the top and important, while other creatures were at the bottom or in between, continued Caledoria. That is strange. I have never thought of life as being a chain. Life is life and is all around us. I mean, the forest is teeming with life. We can look up, we can look down, we can look right, we can look left and find it, commented Pentacote. That's exactly right, Pentacote. Life of the world is complex. People in the world I come from are incapable of grasping its complexity, think that it is simpler than it really is. The realization that they are part of it and of the same worth to all other parts, whether alive or dead, is a fact they cannot accept. If only people from my world had rid themselves of the idea that they were more intelligent and at the top of all the living, they would have turned out differently. They would have been humbled and had respect for all that Perutha had to offer, responded Caledoria. In my opinion, the order of life is very complex. It has many round side branches. The shape of life is more or less like a ball where no one branch can be readily distinguished from another. That is sort of how we view the world here, commented Pentacote. How is that, Pentacote? Asked Caledoria. Chapter 26, The Abduction. You see, when we go out for the hunt, we pray for he or she we will kill, for we consider them brothers and sisters that must be sacrificed in order for us to live, and we thank them for it, responded Pentacote. Just then, and before Pentecoti could finish her sentence, a group of 5 Indians appeared from the south around the pond. As they were taking turns drinking, one of them noticed footprints around the pond, one of which was that of a Penacook Indian moccasin, who then said out loud, "Ala Lama De Taza." The other 4 stopped what they were doing and looked at the footprints and agreed that it was fresh, and also that it was that of a squaw. At that time, there were abductions of Indian women by the British and the colonists. This fact set off alarms in the heads of the 5 Indian men, and they followed the footsteps to behind the waterfall, and there they found the 3 women huddled together. The 5 Indian men surrounded the women, and their leader asked Pentecoti what she was doing there with these strange-looking women as he fingered Caledoria's ears. "They are my friends, and we were just talking and learning English," responded Pentecoti. "Don't you know it is dangerous out here? If you are found here by the white man, they will take you away, and we will never see you again." "What family do you belong to?" asked the leader. "I am from the Gorbuk family," responded Pentecoti. "Very well, we will return you to your family," said the leader as he told the other 4 Indians to tie the hands of Caledoria and Angoli. "What are you doing? They are my friends. Set them free and let them go to their home," yelled Pentecoti. "Be quiet, squaw," said the leader as they proceeded to take the 3 women out of the pond area and into the forest south of the waterfall. After about a mile's walk, they reached the Gorbuk family campsite and hand over Pentecoti. They then proceeded north to their campsite, which was about 2 miles away, with Caledoria and Angoli in tow. Their family was called Penotic, and their campsite was along a river. As they entered the campsite, they were greeted by their family members yelling, "Marhaba Bikom," who immediately started looking at the 2 prisoners with suspicion. They did not understand the meaning of the elephant ears on Caledoria or Angoli's black skin color. The leader's name was Flying Fox. He was a muscular fellow who did not shy away from showing his physique. He grabbed the bindings on Caledoria, dragged her to his hut, and told his wife, Gentle Brooke, to make use of her. So Gentle Brooke assigned Caledoria to chew hides to make them soft and pliable. Flying Fox then grabbed Angoli's bindings and dragged her to another tent belonging to his cousin, Smart Buck, handed her over to Sweet Flower, and told her to make use of her. But Sweet Flower was immediately taken aback by Angoli's skin color, and before she could say anything, Flying Fox had left. Sweet Flower tied Angoli's bindings to a tree and left her there while she went about with her shores that day. That evening, the Penotic family gathered around the campfire to celebrate the end of the day. Angoli was still tied up to the tree, but she could see the shadowy figures dancing to the faint sound of drums and song in the distance. At times the drums would be silent and the singing would be louder, and at other times she could hear the drums beating out a tune. After the festivities were over, Sweet Flower untied Angoli from the tree and guided her into the teepee, where Angoli slept with Smart Buck, herself, and their children. Meanwhile, Caledoria had joined the Penotic family at the campfire that evening. She clapped along when the family clamped, tried to sing when they sang, and they even encouraged her to try to dance with the children to the beat of the drums. When the festivities were over, she took her place in Flying Fox's tent and was able to sleep until she was awoken by his wife the next morning, when she was told to join the children in gathering firewood for the morning meal. Chapter 27. The Search. The night before, Dr. Matthew worried about Caledoria and Angoli when they did not show up for dinner. He thought of going out and searching for them by himself, but then decided to involve the law. He proceeded to the constable for Portsmouth on Main Street. He knocked on the front door of the constable's house, and when a young girl of about 12 years old answered the door, he asked for Constable Wilbur Counsel. "One moment, please," said the girl. "Who may I ask are you?" "I am Dr. Matthew of Front Street," answered he. The little girl closed the door, and after about a minute and a half, Constable Counsel opened the door and said, "Yes, doctor, how can I help you?" as he motioned for the doctor to come into his home. They proceeded to the den, and each sat down when the doctor said that 2 occupants of his apartment were missing when asked who the occupants were. The doctor told him of his guest, Mrs. Smith, and his slave, Angoli. When asked to describe them, the doctor did. The constable then asked where they could be, and the doctor responded and said, "The last time they were late, they were at the pond with the waterfall south of town near Sagemont Creek." "Thank you for this information, Dr. Matthew. I suggest you go home now to your apartment and wait for them in case they show up there. I will gather up my deputies and other willing folk from town, go out hunting for them, and God willing, we will find them," said the constable. Dr. Matthew headed back to his apartment, hoping they would be there when he arrived, but they were not. He lit an oil lamp and sat in front of the window right above the front door of his clinic and watched out for them. He saw people running on Front Street, carrying torches, who headed north into the heart of town. When the commotion stopped, an eerily quiet fell over the apartment. He was now thinking terrible thoughts about what could have happened to them. They might have drowned in the pond, been killed by a stray cannon salvo from the British forces, or abducted by the Indians. After about an hour of these dark feelings, he grew restless and started pacing up and down in his living room. It was as if his muscles were on a mission of their own and wanted to go out and search for them, instead of wasting so much time contemplating, deliberating, and reflecting on what might have happened. Slowly his mind was thinking the same thing and was also growing restless, and he made a determination to go out and hunt for them. He thought of making a torch so he could see his way in the darkness. He could not find a stick in his apartment, so he broke one of his chairs and took its leg, wrapping the end of it in some cloths he found in the kitchen, and then emptied the oil from the oil lamp onto his torch and lit it. He headed south towards the pond and waterfall at Sagemont Creek. It was not easy, for it was midnight, and the moon was a sliver helping him not. After about a half hour, the torch burnt out, and he had to feel his way from tree to bush to tree, stumbling on snags and giant ferns. When he arrived, falling into the pond 3 hours later, he spent about half an hour wringing out his clothes. He was so tired and exhausted at this point that he decided to take a nap in the clearing next to the pond. As he gathered his jacket under his head, he felt this hard object bothering his right inside, so he sat up and tried to examine it, and he discovered that it was a burnt-out torch, and realized that the constable and the townspeople had already been there and left. He wondered if they had found Caledoria Angoli and took them back to town. He certainly hoped that was the case, but other thoughts crept into his mind. Were they alive? Were they dead? Or maybe they did not find them at all. He reasoned that if the townspeople had found them, they would take them back to town, and there they would be safe. And if they did not find them, the townspeople would head west to continue the search. So he decided to head west in the event that they were not found at the waterfall. Chapter 28. The Pursuit. The constable and about 35 townspeople had also headed south to the pond and waterfall off of Sagemont Creek and found that the missing two were not there. They all took a rest there and recuperated from the long trek from town in the dark, with torches throwing shadowy figures around, making it harder for them to see their way. Some torches burned out, while others were on their last leg. Constable Wilbur thought of heading back to town to replenish their burnt-out torches, raised his voice and said, "Listen, all of you, we should head back to town, stock up on torches, and head west where the two women must have been taken." A voice from the crowd said, "We might as well stay in town for that matter. It will be too late to rescue them. I vote to continue the search before it becomes too late." There was a moment of silence as the search team contemplated what was just said. Constable Wilbur raised his voice again and said, "Those in favor of continuing west, raise your hands." Slowly, about half the team raised their hands. Constable Wilbur decided then that they head west, despite being short on torches. Another voice from the crowd asked, "Why are we heading west?" "To the east is the river. To the south, we will find the British garrison. Our only option is to head west," responded Constable Wilbur. "But that is Indian territory, Constable," complained another voice. "We have enough weapons to take care of ourselves from the diggers," said one more voice. Another moment of silence passed, then the constable asked, "Any more questions before we move on?" After another minute of silence, the constable stood up and said, "Let's go. and headed west while the rest of the team followed in the darkness with the few torches that were still lit. They traveled about a mile when they came up to a distant flicker of light, which they thought was a campfire for an Indian clan. The constable whispered that they should put out their torches and approach in stealth fashion the campfire with muskets ready. But before he could finish his sentence, an arrow struck one man in the eye, and he fell in pain. Realizing that they have been found, Constable Wilbur uttered the words, "Charge!" The townspeople stormed the campsite, firing their muskets and stabbing with their daggers, the inhabitants of the Indian camp killing most, while sustaining 3 deaths and 12 wounded. One of the Indians was able to speak English, and when asked where the 2 missing women were, they said they were taken north. Before the rest of the group headed north after replenishing the supply of torches, a couple of them were left behind to care for the wounded. As for the rest of the Indians, they were all killed lest they cause trouble for those who were left behind. After about 2 miles, they came up to a large campfire in the distance that must have belonged to a larger group of Indians. This time, they crawled in silence, and so they were undetected. They saw Angoli tied to a tree. As they approached, they were whispering to her to be quiet, and they asked her where Mrs. Smith was, and she told him that she was somewhere around the campfire. They untied Angoli, then organized themselves in a V-shape with the constable in the lead, and stormed the camp with muskets firing. The battle lasted for about 3 minutes, and when it was over, they had taken Caledoria to where Angoli was behind the battle line. The townspeople had lost 1 person and 6 wounded. This time they did not leave any Indians alive. At first, and in the commotion, they did not notice Caledoria's elephant ears. But when the dust settled and the adrenaline was calming down, Timothy, one of the townspeople, noticed Caledoria's ears and intently gazed at them. He then started to walk around Caledoria and acted as if he was sniffing something. At this point, Caledoria started to cover her ears with her hands, but it was too late, for others had seen what Timothy was doing and noticed the aberration in her ears. Chapter 29. The Stake. The townspeople started to gather around Caledoria, looking at her from top to bottom. She started to get uncomfortable, and a flight response was starting to build up within her. One man suggested the shape of her ears was due to a birth defect, and another man countered with, "I've never seen such a birth defect in my life." "Maybe she comes from a different country," exclaimed another voice in the crowd. Timothy then whispered in the ear of the constable, "She must be a witch." As luck would have it, a priest overheard Timothy's comment and took it to heart to start yelling, "Witch! Witch!" As the townspeople heard the priest, they started to yell the same thing. At this point, Caledoria started running into the woods as fast as she could. After a few confusing moments, the townspeople started running after her as Angoli hid out of sight behind a tree and watched. Caledoria had a head start at this point, and as she lifted her dress to make it easier to run, she stumbled and fell. As the crowd gained on her, she got up and commenced to run as fast as she could, but her fall slowed her to the point that the crowd was upon her before she could get ahead of steam, and soon they had her pinned to the ground. She tried to get away by biting and kicking while screaming at those who were holding her down, so they turned her over on her stomach and hog-tied her hands and legs together behind her. They then carried her face down back to the camp, where they started to interrogate her. The priest asked her if she was a witch, which she denied. He then held a cross to her forehead and started to talk in a strange tongue. "I feel the presence of evil in this woman. No use taking her back to town. We need to burn her at the stake here, and within the next hour," declared the priest, as he lifted the cross to her forehead. By this time daylight had appeared, and a group proceeded to go out to gather firewood, while others erected the stake next to the campfire. After placing the firewood around the stake, the priest asked her if she believed in the glory of God the Creator and His Son, Jesus Christ. She said she did not. She said that God was a creation of the social imagination to boost its people's self-importance into believing they were the most favored of all species on earth. The priest then said to the rest of the group, "Aha! I told you she was a devil in disguise, but she was given away by her flattened ears, thanks to the Lord. She is in league with that fiend to discredit you in what you believe. She has come here to deceive you and lead you onto the dark and low path of that mischievous spirit." And as he pointed to several people in the crowd, he said, "Tie her to the stake." 4 people untied her from the bindings she was in, raised her up to the stake as she was fighting them off, and finally subdued her by tying her hands and feet to the stake. "Do you have anything to say before I set you on fire?" asked the priest. She said, "I believe that you are not more intelligent than any other creature on earth. Neither are you better or deserve more privilege over any other plant or animal. You have developed into a creature governed by your imagination that has made the mistake of thinking you can control nature or manage it. Nature is more complex than what people can comprehend. Anything that you create to manage nature is flawed. People should confine their values to those that confine their activities to the boundaries created by the natural world, to live a simple life and follow simple rules. You should believe in what ties them to the real world and not the imaginary. You should be humble and not grandiose. You should bow to the natural world and not put yourselves above it. If you do not do and believe in what I say, your destiny will be bleak. You will succeed in the short run, but at a tremendous cost later on. So heed to the natural world and let it lead you to a simpler life, free of greed and short-sighted imaginary misconceptions." Just then, the priest instructed Timothy to rip off her clothes, lit a torch, and plunged it into the pile of firewood around her feet, and said, "Burn, you wicked witch, burn!" As the flames engulfed Calidoria, she screamed in pain as the group of townspeople watched. Some looked away as others were throwing up. The screaming lasted for about 15 minutes, and gradually subsided as she lost consciousness and then died. The priest kept the fire going by feeding the flames with more wood until everything was reduced to ashes and a few bones. As the ashes were smoldering and the townspeople were getting ready to leave, Dr. Matthew entered the campground. Chapter 30. The Trial. As soon as Angoli saw him enter the campground, she ran to him from behind the tree where she had seen everything happen, kneeled in front of him, and asked for his forgiveness. "Where is Calidoria Angoli?" he asked, and Angoli started to cry. The constable then stepped towards the doctor and told him they burned her at the stake, while pointing at her ashes, for she was a witch doing the deeds of the devil in Portsmouth. "She was harming no one," said the doctor. "She was my guest, and I was responsible for her. She was innocent, I tell you. She was not a witch, but a widow that I took in after the death of her husband." The doctor then started to cry himself, kneeling in front of the constable, with palms rubbing his eyes. The priest moved towards the doctor from behind the crowd, and told the constable to arrest the doctor, for he harbored a viable hand of the devil. "Stand up, you fool," said the constable to the doctor. Slowly the doctor got up, and while he was standing there, he thought of running, for he knew the outcome was not going to be pleasant. And so, he made a dash for the dense forest, and managed to disappear. The doctor backtracked to the pond with the waterfall, where he took a rest and refreshed himself with some water over his head. He then realized he was out in the open, so he dashed into this dense forest again. There he thought of his predicament. He was trapped. He could not go back to town, for he would surely be found and executed, yet he could not live alone in the forest for very long. He spent that day hunting for some food and managed to find a crippled squirrel, which he had for dinner. That evening he figured he would die if he did not go back to town, so he decided to take his chances in town, and perhaps he could talk himself out of the predicament he was in. The next morning he decided to walk the mile back to town and give himself up. As he entered the town from the south, walking in the middle of the street towards the constable's office, townspeople were pointing and young boys were throwing stones at him. One stone struck him in the head and he fell unconscious. When he awoke, he found himself on the floor in a prisoner's cell room. It must have been in the middle of the night, since he could not find any oil lamps lit. He touched his forehead and noticed that it was grainy, and figured that that was dried blood. He crawled towards a wall and sat up, leaning against it. He went over and over again what he was going to say in defense of himself. He realized it was time to save his life, and so he had to lie. He's going to lie about not knowing that Caledoria had elephant ears. But he felt terrible because he would be betraying her if he did so. About midday, the constable walked up to the prisoner cell room and ordered the doctor to put his hands behind his back and face the wall, while chains were placed around his wrists and ankles. Constable Wilbur then pulled on the chains and led the doctor to the courtroom across the street where many of the townspeople were gathered in front of Stephen Council, who was a cousin of the constable. The doctor was then shoved into a chair in front of the judge, who asked, "How do you plead, doctor?" The doctor answered with a question, "What are the charges, Your Honor?" "You are charged with aiding and abetting the devil's work," responded the judge. "I plead not guilty, Your Honor," responded the doctor. "Anyone here is able to defend the doctor?" asked the judge. "I will, Your Honor," came a voice from the crowd in the back of the room. "And who may you be, sir? And please come forward," asked the judge. "I am Dr. Josiah Bartlett, Your Honor," responded the voice as he came forward and stood next to the defendant, Dr. Matthew. "Very well, Dr. Josiah Bartlett. Constable Counsel, please give your opening statement," said the judge. "Your Honor, the defendant, Dr. Matthew, defended a bona fide witch who was burned at the stake after giving a long speech about what she stood for, which was anti-God and anti-Christ, that we all know is the foundation on which the King's colony laws are built upon. He therefore is in league with and defending the devil," responded the constable. "Dr. Bartlett, please give your opening statement," asked the judge of the defense. "Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Matthew is a respected member of the community of Portsmouth. He is also a signer of the Declaration of Independence from the King of England. I have known Dr. Matthew for the past 10 years, and never has he raised a voice against God or his son Jesus Christ. A matter of fact, he is a law-abiding, God-fearing, and of the highest example of what a good citizen is. I declare that he is innocent of any and all the charges against him," said Dr. Bartlett as he stood in front of the audience in the courtroom. "Very well. Constable Counsel, please plead your case," said the judge as he pointed at Constable Counsel. "After verifying and burning at the stake a witch by the name of Mrs. Smith, who admitted to being anti-God, anti-Christ, and pro-nature, Dr. Matthew entered the campground pleading her innocence and declared, 'She was not a witch,'" said Constable Counsel as he looked onto the audience. "But she was a witch, and we proved it, for she burned screaming like one, and was a physical aberration not of this earth." Dr. Josiah then stood up from his chair, faced the constable, and asked, "What proof do you have she was an aberration and a witch, sir?" "She had ears like those of an elephant," responded the constable. "Her ears could have been a birth defect, like a mole, a large nose, or short stature," countered Dr. Josiah. "I have seen moles, large noses, and short statures as birth defects before, but I have never seen a birth defect like her ears. She was a witch if I ever saw one. She even tried to hide them as a witch would do in the face of good Christian fellows," continued the constable as he looked at the group of townspeople in the room, who then cheered him on and yelled, "She was a witch. She was a witch." "I rest my case, Your Honor," said the constable. "Do you have anything more to say, Dr. Josiah?" asked the judge. "Yes, Your Honor. I contend that her ears were only a birth defect, that she was innocent of the charges of being a witch, and that the townspeople and the constable made a mistake in assuming she was, and burned her at the stake. I therefore plead with the court to have mercy on our fellow, Dr. Matthew, and declare him innocent of all charges," said Dr. Josiah. Just as the judge was about to pronounce judgment, the courtroom became silent, and a soft voice from behind the crowd said, "He did not know she had elephant ears, my lord." "Who is that?" said the judge. As the black figure moved towards the judge and the crowd made way for her, Ungoli repeated, "He did not know, Your Honor." Several from the crowd gasped as she moved forward. "Who are you to be coming here and interrupting me?" asked the judge. "I am the property of Dr. Matthew. I am his bed warmer, and neither he nor I knew of Mrs. Smith's ears, for she had them covered with her bonnet at all times," said Angoli. "Your Honor, this is a biased witness, and her words are not worth the dirt we are walking on," said the constable. "Nevertheless, I will have to take whatever this witness says into consideration," said the judge, who then slammed his gavel on his desk and said the court is recessed for an hour, after which he would render the verdict. During the recess, the judge thought about Angoli's words and realized that if she had lied and someone found out about it, she would have been hung within an hour. So he decided to take her testimony into consideration. When the court resumed its session, and the judge quieted down the audience by hammering on his table and yelled "quiet" several times and said, "I have decided on a verdict after careful consideration of all testimony and the facts of the matter." He then continued and said, "The defendant will now rise." Dr. Matthew arose slowly from his seat and stood facing the judge. "Dr. Matthew, based on the evidence presented here in this court of the King of England, I pronounce you innocent of all charges." The courtroom grew quiet after a long gasp. After approximately 30 seconds, all heard a voice that yelled, "Warlock." Chapter 31 Payment. This sent shivers up Dr. Matthew's spine, who then sat down holding Dr. Josiah's arm very tightly. Dr. Josiah then patted Dr. Matthew's hand that was on his arm to calm him down. Josiah then stood up and motioned for Dr. Matthew to do the same, and they walked over to Angoli, where Dr. Josiah took her hand, and the three of them walked out of the courtroom in silence. When they reached Front Street, Dr. Josiah told Dr. Matthew that he had another engagement, so he had to leave and bid them farewell. Dr. Matthew and Angoli walked quickly to his clinic, opened the door, and locked it from within. They then proceeded to go upstairs and sat at the kitchen table. "Angoli, you realize that you are in grave danger here if you stay," said the doctor. "I had to do it," said Angoli, "and I thank you for that. But you are now in a very unsafe situation. If anybody found out that you lied in court just to save me, well, they will hang both of us," said the doctor. "I don't want to lie, Dr. Matthew. What am I to do?" "I must send you to a very faraway place from here where no one will find out." "I'd rather go home, Dr. Matthew." "I know. That would be the safest place for you. But getting you there is going to be a problem. I don't know of any ship captain who will take a slave back to Africa," said the doctor. "Please, Dr. Matthew, find me a way back to Africa." "All right, I can't promise you that I can do it, but I will surely try my best to get you back to Africa," said the doctor. That night, the doctor took to his bed, and Angoli laid on the couch. It was a sleepless night, and at approximately midnight, Angoli walked silently over to the doctor and slowly crawled into bed next to him. The end. Copyright 2020 by Hassan A. Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system, without the written permission of the author. Contact ostahmed@yahoo.com. ISBN 978-1716-311178, printed in the United States of America.